Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created by fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. And there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week on Shudder is Soul Station, the animated prequel to last year's hit zombie film Train to Busan. As the government struggles to shut down the area around a zombie outbreak, a man desperately searches for his runaway daughter. The director of Train to Busan brings you a new perspective on the events of Train to Busan, bringing George Romero-esque social commentary into thrilling, gory, animated zombie horror. Stream it now only on Shudder.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Again, that's promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
The Knoxville Horror Film Fest returns October 20th to the 22nd for its ninth annual celebration of sinister cinema at Regal Cinemas Downtown West 8. Highlights of this year's fest include the 4K restoration of Suspiria, which is gorgeous, Blade of the Immortal, which is Takeshi Miike's 100th movie, Better Watch Out, The Endless, and 40th anniversary of Hasu screening. In total, you can see 10 features, over 30 shorts, and witness the insanity of the Grindhouse Grindout filmmaking competition. Tickets and more info can be found at KnoxvilleHorrorFest.com. And I'm judging it, so expect good decisions.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 69 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G.
69.
Very relevant today.
Yeah.
Naughty. Let's get naughty. Ryan has already broken out the...
Not in the workplace. Not in the workplace, people.
Jesus.
Well, Ryan's already broken out the freaking whiskey, so it's gonna get yeah, wild.
You guys
well,
are
hello.
It's been a yes. Passing around some whiskey here.
Yes. Well, hello. I'm Rob G. Ryan Turek is here with us.
Hi, guys.
Hi. You're just, you're just going to come in and right. out whenever
they
feel
those,
like
those,
it.
I'm like, Papa was a Rolling Stone, man.
He sounds great for Skype. It's pretty good. The connection's solid.
Also, Elric Kane.
I'm here.
What's up?
Present.
Rebecca McKendry.
Hello, guys.
And we have a special guest co-host with us.
Is this where I introduce myself?
You can.
Okay.
But I'll introduce you.
Okay, I wasn't sure. You all stared at me. My name is Brennan Klein.
Hi,
and
who are you?
I'm a former, I guess, writer for Blumhouse.com.
You are?
I'm the co-host of a horror podcast called Scream 101,
yep.
where myself and a horror novice review horror films, and that's about it. And I'm missing the Riverdale season premiere for this, so it better be good.
Wow.
Whoa.
True.
He there has is. Thrown
and
down.
And he's wearing a Shockwaves t-shirt, and he has played trivia forever.
Yeah.
So
and
there's
a
lot of background.
Yeah.
Here. I sit in this room sometimes, and Becca yells at me.
Do I?
You're like, he likes Prom Night 3.
He likes Prom Night 3. No, it's true. No, Brennan worked, he did some stuff with me at Fangoria. And then
when
I came over to Blumhouse, I was like, dude, you're here. And so, yeah, Brennan and I go way back.
Speaking of Fangoria, there's a great article in Entertainment Weekly about the rise and fall of Fangoria.
Ooh.
Apparently there is a Halloween issue hitting today, when this episode airs,
nice.
Of EW. That's all like mostly horror, but I've been told that we should be taking a look at the issue.
Okay.
But there's a great article up on Entertainment Weekly right now about Fangoria.
On the website.
On the website.
Right. I am looking at it right
it
now. It's by Clark Collis.
Yeah, it's by Clark Collis. It couldn't fit into the print edition, but Clark made sure that it was online.
I'm hoping that there'll be another chapter that still rise, fall, and rise again. Some form.
I know.
Somehow.
You never know.
Fingers crossed.
But Brennan, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming
me.
On.
And I hope you didn't bring too many, like what you've seen this week, because we're already going to be packed to the gills.
No, I know. I was going to just run through everything I've seen this year because I've never been on the podcast. But
which would be fair.
I can cut it down.
Fair assumption.
Well, we're in week two of October.
Yeah.
You know, I've been trying to do one horror movie a night, and it's been pretty. pretty eventful. I mean,
you've succeeded, correct?
I've succeeded so far. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, there's been a couple of like late nights where I'm kind of dozing off and I have to finish the next morning. But Brian Collins, meanwhile, is listening, going, ha, 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 ha.
"Yeah, years. I got Whatever. Years on you guys. I've been hanging on for. I'm doing 31 anthologies. Yeah. I had a TV die in the middle of it. I did not let that stop me. I rented Twilight Zone on YouTube, Twilight Zone the movie, and watched it on my laptop.
Nice.
So I've succeeded, and in fact, I have two movies to watch when I get home: one for work and one for pleasure.
Nice.
Immediately after that. So
what's the best so far? The best new discovery of these anthologies?
Yeah, you know what? I guess we can dive into it right now.
Yeah.
I've been watching quite a lot. Most of the first batch I've already seen. The two newest ones I've seen up until now, because we're only 10 days in, or 13 by the time this airs. The one that Scream Factory just put out called After Midnight, which I know Becca has brought up on the show previously.
Yep, I've talked about that one before. Mm. I always said that it had one of my favorite wraparounds.
And it is. It's a super cool wraparound. This is around 1989. So it's got that weird... It's that wonderful era of horror where it feels like a 90s movie, but it's still got a little bit of that 80s in it. Mm. You know, it's like that weird turning point. A lot of recognizable faces. I don't know their names. It's just like, oh, that person, like, that's the TV girl from Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Yeah, you watch it, and it's a lot of, like, TV actors.
Like, all these people that are in other horror things from the time. And, the wraparound is so bizarre because it's basically – it's almost like it's almost like its own story. Like, it's a good, like, 15 minutes into the movie before you're like, am I watching an anthology? Because it follows this teacher who kind of is giving this course on fear and how to, like, elicit fear out of, you know, and he's, like, kind of instigating his students. And then, 15 minutes in, a bunch of them are invited over, which is shady as it is. And then they each start telling a story like, this is the scariest thing I've ever heard about happening. And so each of them is pretty cool. There's one in particular where it's like the guy, he's one of the bikers from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, like stalking these girls in a car, and then like his dogs are after them too. So that was really cool.
Is that the one with the self-help line in it? Let me make sure I'm remembering this right. Anthology. It was a girl in a self-help line, and somebody starts calling, or that may be a different anthology.
No, yeah, that's at the very end.
Okay,
that's the final skit. Which
I don't remember any more than self-help line, but I remember thinking that one was pretty tense.
Yeah, and that one stars Marge. The girl in Species. I'm blanking on names because, well, the thing is this: as Elric said, he's like doing 31 anthologies is actually like watching 120 films, yeah, and so crazy. Even though we're 10 to 13 days in, I've already watched, I mean, if you average 4 or 5 per night, so it's like, you know, 20 some odd stories that I'm mixing up in my head. But yeah, the Scream Factory just put this out. It's really cool. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it, but it's actually a pretty worthwhile anthology to check out. And the one with the biker guy and the dog was the one that stood out to me. And the conclusion of the wraparound is really kind of wacky.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that one. And then I just watched one called Tales of Terror, which is all based on Vincent Price is in every segment. It's all based on Edgar Allan Poe stuff. And this one's pretty amazing. There's a variation on the Black Cat and the one where the guy gets
Telltale Heart.
Yes, it's similar to that, but it's Peter Lorre and Vincent Price, and so you know the tone kind of changes from segment to segment, but the middle segment is those two, and there's this it's worth it for this amazing sequence where they kind of have a wine off, where basically like one of them is the bigger wine connoisseur than the other, and so it's this long scene of just Peter Lorre and Vincent Price drinking wine, and progressively getting more and more drunk.
Nice.
So that one was spectacular. So those were the newer ones. On top of that, you know, I watched Twilight Zone the movie, which I hadn't seen in a long time. And although I like it, you know what's funny about that is it's, to be candid, it's a little difficult to watch knowing what happened on that movie. Like now as an adult, I haven't seen it since I was a kid. And that's a very uncomfortable segment to watch. Knowing what happened.
It's a great segment for our time, though.
Very relevant right now, absolutely. Yeah. And I always loved the kind of the beginning and the end with Dan Aykroyd. That was always one of my favorites.
Something really scary.
Which scared?
I think that's one of the best creatures too. I love that creature.
It frightened the shit out of me when I was a kid. That and the girl without the mouth.
I had
to fast forward.
Which was the Joe Dante one, and then I really loved the John Lithgow one. But it's funny. It's because I know that that was, I think Joe Dante said, he's like, the downside to that movie is that they were forced to remake old episodes rather than do original ones. And so that's kind of its downside, is it's all stories that you kind of already know.
Which doesn't hit you when you first see it as a kid, but you grow as a horror fan.
Yeah.
You do your research and you watch all the Twilight Zones and you go,
that's perfect. Yeah, so
it's, you know, it's still good and I like it, but it didn't hold up as well as I remember because I was like, oh, this is kind of.
Kick the Can was always the one episode that I didn't ever care for.
It made me cry. I liked that one. It was
because you have feelings.
It was more, I know. You're just
Roboteric.
He's got a cold, black, crispy heart inside. No, that one, I didn't appreciate till I got older. I fast forwarded through it when I was a kid, but when I got older, that one, it feels more Twilight Zone-y to me. Like that one actually feels like a Twilight Zone episode where it's like teaching a lesson about morality and things like that.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, Shudder has been, I own most of these films. Either I have them on Blu-ray or, I rented Twilight Zone on YouTube, but Shudder has been a great help. I just watched last night one I've already seen before, The House That Dripped Blood, which is, I think it's 4 or 5 stories, but it's written by Robert Block, the author of Psycho. They're all in it. Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee. It is spectacular. It has my favorite Christopher Lee joke, which I Instagrammed last night, which is basically, and I don't know, my guess, it's just so funny. I think Christopher Lee is the lead of the third segment. And so immediately following it is a segment about, for lack of a better term, an actor like a Peter Vincent type that's just so bitter about everything. And so he's like, I miss the old movies, you know, Frankenstein, The Mummy, Dracula, Bela Lugosi one, not this new fella. And so within, like, to get that, like, kind of, joke on Christopher Lee's behalf when he's in the last segment is great. But yeah, check out Shudder because they do have The House of Trip Blood and they have a whole bunch of these anthologies that I'm watching. So that's where I'm starting. What about you, Ulrich?
A couple that I'll just do quickly because I've talked about them on here before, but they've come out on Blu-ray from Warner Archive, both of them. So I want us to give lots of love to it because I want Warner Archive to put out more horror is my goal. And that's The Hidden, which I've talked about endlessly here.
Such a good movie.
And they're just, and speaking of, you know, you're just kind of in a roundabout way talking about John Landis. Look, The Innocent Blood is just one of the most underrated little fun gems of horror. It's silly, but it's like a gangster film. Don Rickles.
Nice. I'm with you on this. This kicked off my October. It was my
Don Rickles
one.
Is gold.
Don
in that
Rickles
movie.
Is gold. It's such a simple, so weird movie.
Yeah, and it's one that I didn't see till about, I don't know, about 7 years ago. So it wasn't one that was always on my radar.
Well,
but
when I was a kid, heard about the sex scene.
Oh my god! Right? Yeah.
When you were in high school, middle school in my case, when I heard about it, they were like, "You need to see the sex scene," and I was like, "What?" And then I had to sneak a VHS copy to watch it. Then I was kind of like, it's not a big deal. I've seen worse.
Your
worse is better, I should say.
There's no Rickles in that.
But guys, that was the original.
I don't think I've seen this movie.
Oh, my
really?
God.
Yeah.
You're going to love it.
Yeah. It's basically a vampire in Pittsburgh.
And it's weird.
It's a very beautiful vampire in Pittsburgh.
Gangster.
I can remember the cover. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen this.
It's Chaz Palminteri. Yes. Working himself up to a Bronx Tale.
Yeah. Anthony LaPaglia. There's a lot of good people in that, but it's just both these movies look glorious. So I just, because I didn't need to rewatch either because I've seen, I just kind of scanned them both to see how they looked and they looked great. So it just makes me excited that, you know, if companies like that start opening up their horror vaults and there's going to be some really great stuff put up.
I got to dig up, because I interviewed the late Robert Loggia for The Psycho Legacy.
That's right. He's great in it.
And I did a bit about some of his other movies and he told a great story of how he scared the shit out of Don Rickles on Innocent Blood because he was very serious in method and Don Rickles was never. And so he said the first time he vamped out on him, he's like, I scared the shit out of Rickles and he never bothered me again for the rest of the movie.
He's the best. I love him so much. He's so intense. So that there are a couple that I think would actually be brilliant for you guys to pick up now that we're in the month. Actually, I was just in New York this weekend and it was late night and I couldn't sleep. You know, once you're in New York. And so I looked at one of the theaters, Quad was playing The Old Dark House in a 4K restoration.
I love that movie.
The movie is only like 76 minutes. So I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I go see it. And I thought it was a cool little movie. Like I can't say I loved it. It's a weird one because it's comic mostly. Yeah. And it kind of built, it's very predictable, but it is fun. Like it's one I hadn't seen. It's one of the few James Whale knows how to make movies. I've always liked his films. Yeah. This is just one. For some reason, I think I thought it was going to be Cat and the Canary, which I always remember liking a lot, but hadn't seen in a long time, but it's neat. And
how
that's one
4K
to look
out
for. I mean,
for a film that came out in the early 1900s,
it's like you can't really tell.
It
looks
not really
clear,
cinematic.
But
I mean, it's just a house. I mean, there's nothing
it's
really
a rare,
cinematic.
It's rainy.
Carlos Fun is like the big grunt, but it looked good. But it's so hard to see that when you're watching like a movie like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it just looks clean. It didn't, I couldn't tell, but I know that Blu-ray is out right now. Mm-hmm. So whatever they're showing, that's kind of on the way out. And well, just quickly, I got to give a shout out to Happy Death Day. I know we're going to be talking about it, but me and Rob got to have a little screening of it here because we hadn't seen it because of guests coming on the show. And A, this is a super fun movie.
Well, you know, it's funny, it's like, because it was just me and Elric in mini theater. So like, I'm sure this will play so much better with it. But we had fun. We were like laughing out loud and talking to each other.
This is in the Blumhouse Theater, by the way.
Yeah. I had had a terrible, it was like one of the most frustrating days I'd had all year.
You didn't even want to stay.
I didn't even want to come do the show last week, and nothing to do with the show. I was just so pissed off from work. I came in here, did the show, I was fine, watched that, and I turned to Rob, I think, when it ended, and go, I feel fine now.
It feel good.
And I had a friend who said his partner really doesn't like horror, but had seen the trailer and thought it looked interesting. I said, you know what? I think this is the perfect date movie for the partner who's like a little averse to horror, because this is really just fun. And for hardcore horror fans, it's so hard to know how people are going to react to movies like this. But like both me and Rob had a lot of fun with it. And I want to say one thing about the lead, and a lot of it I think comes down to the heart of the lead performances by both Jessica Roth. I'm not sure if I'm saying Roth. That. And then whoever the guy was.
The kid.
Israel Broussard.
Who's great.
That kid is a freaking star.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, he's so good in this movie.
But the reason I'm bringing this up is because I had then a strange experience. So I'm watching that. I can honestly say I occasionally see a film
where... Did you wake up in a dorm room?
Yeah, no, I did. I woke up again. No, but I had one of those experiences where you see an actress who I literally think in that movie, like to me, that's a star turn. Like you watch someone go, yeah, she deserves to be a star. I got on the plane and I finally watched
Jess
Mummy.
Under?
No, I watched The Mummy.
Oh.
She's in The Mummy, right?
No.
Is she not? Oh, so while I was watching The Mummy, I thought it was the same actress as the lead.
Oh, my God, no.
Who is that girl then?
I'm looking at the girl right in The Mummy? Annabelle
Wallace. The blonde girl.
It's Annabelle Wallace.
Okay,
yeah,
watching it. So I'm sitting on the plane watching this movie. This is after it. And I was going, man, she's really boring in this. And she was so good in the other. So I was all excited to say, well, that's good. It makes me happy to know I was supporting.
Jessica, you can find in La La Land. She's in La La Land.
She's apparently in a remake of Valley Girl.
Yeah, Valley Girl's coming out next year. Yeah.
So now these things have less of a pairing in my notes, but I will say about The Mummy, listen to what Rob said about The Mummy. It's pretty accurate. I will say this. I think it's the most conflicted film I've ever seen in a theater, like about what it is. Like it's incredibly conflicted. But what's weird is the setup, the first 5 minutes, I actually really kind of liked. And then every time it went to like just the slow moving dead zombies and then the Knights of Templar type zombies, I was like, oh, I really like that. The main female antagonist is the villain. I thought she was really good. And then the action doesn't work, and the main character of Cruz is one of the most misplaced casted characters.
Awful.
And just it's like he's literally he got given a Briscoe County Jr. script.
Yes,
and they wanted Bruce Campbell, and instead he's in the wrong movie, like three times the wrong movie. Oh, and you're like, what are you guys thinking? And even Crow's pretty good. Like I actually kind of like Crow when he's playing when he becomes Hyde, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. You didn't like that?
No.
See, it didn't bother me, but I just couldn't help but think, oh man, in here there was like these remnants of what could have been a good movie, and I didn't hate it. I was just like watching on a plane. I started on a plane, so there's nothing at stake.
Yeah,
I didn't think it was a good movie, but I thought Cruz was, and I usually would come out on the side like I think Cruz is a really good movie star. And this is one of the worst things he's ever done. Like it just, and I felt almost bad for him because it's such a stupid. He's also the kind of actor we don't want to see play dumb people, and he's playing such a dumb character, and then it tries to be serious suddenly, and you're like, no, guys, it's just a terribly conceived film.
Yeah,
but I do like the quality of the zombies and monsters.
I'm kind of nervous because I was actually very excited about everything I've heard about Bride of Frankenstein leading up to this. And then like last week, they kind of put it on pause, whatever the hell that means. And so that really kind of bums me out.
But didn't you hear like, wasn't it yesterday they said Gal Gadot could be Bride?
Yeah, that's all rumors.
It's all rumors. She would be fascinating.
But you know, Bill Condon was pretty much saying like, don't worry about any other movies. I'm not connecting it to anything. It's its own thing. And you're like, great, this sounds awesome. And they're like, pause.
Oh, because they don't like that idea, probably. So anyway, that movie, you know, I wouldn't recommend it. But and especially because Jessica's not in it. Here, I thought I was onto something, guys.
Oh, my God.
Totally wrong. Totally wrong.
That's funny. I'll take it.
All right, what else?
What'd you see, Turek?
I've just been plowing through. I know you guys did your October list, and I've watched a horror movie every night. I've watched Innocent Blood, New Nightmare, Babadook, Happy Death Day. We went to the premiere. Friday the 13th.
Which one?
New Blood, Demons, Hellraiser, Omen, Scream 2, and Urban Legend.
Were you just going to like run past Friday the 13th and not qualify it as New Blood? Were you just going to run that
no,
off?
No, no, no. Because as you saw, I was getting a phone call came in.
how are you feeling about the psychic energy?
Not so much.
Oh, you're still not
feeling it? No, come on.
Sorry, guys.
Tina.
Sorry, guys. I'm no good on New Blood.
That
one's a real slog. It's really tough.
The first parts are a little slow.
There are some really slow parts. It adds nothing really new to the mix other than Tina, who's got the Carrie vibe. And it really bothers me. Really bothers me when she does the whole and all of a sudden Jason's mask flies off and he gives this look of fear and I was like, no, fuck you. Jason doesn't get scared.
Jason doesn't get surprised.
He's confused. No. He doesn't know what
he's like. What do I do?
No, Jason doesn't get confused.
He's also full zombie by that point, which I always think's a little weird.
Crazy it's
a
telekinetic very, email very ripping my shit off.
No,
he's vulnerable. He's exposed. Yeah. He's naked. Jason doesn't
get Jason doesn't get vulnerable.
Brennan, Donnie, you're out of your element, Donnie. You're out of your element.
I mean, listen, out of the mix, I'll just kind of run through. Innocent Blood, really interesting movie. Yeah. Very simple. There's a lot of John Landis goofiness, a lot of cameos. There's a ton of cameos. There's like Tom Savini and Sam Raimi and da-da-da. A lot of car chases and car accidents. Overall, it's a fun experience, but it's just it felt very hollow to me. New Nightmare. I think it holds up great.
10 out of 10.
New Nightmare is really, really interesting. It's like good movie for Wes Craven, who I tried to explain this on Instagram, but I was just too lazy and tired. when Wes Craven gets the job of, not the job because I know he pitched it to Bob Shea, but, where do you go after Freddy's dead? Where could you possibly go? Oh, comment on the industry and comment on Freddy's effect in the world, which is really, really interesting.
And I love that it's scary. Plus, my daughter, when she was like a little baby, Nightmare is scary.
I threw shade at Turk and we went back and forth on Instagram.
You called him like a Power Ranger villain or something?
He looks like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle villain to me in that movie. Does not look scary.
Whatever I love is going it in theory. On with Freddy, that's a parent's nightmare, what's happening to Miko Hughes.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yes. No. Totally yeah. is.
But he doesn't look scary. I mean, I don't know. That's my.
I like New Freddy.
Yeah, okay. I liked New Freddy in that one.
I like the movie. That's the only thing I don't like about it. And then Turk immediately hit back with, "Yeah, Jason and Jason Goes to Hell."
fucking marshmallow Jason.
And I tried to be like, but no, his mask is like burned into his face. And all right, it's silly. No. Sorry.
Plus, when Marnie was like little baby, we got her this stuffed dinosaur, and I sat it at the edge of her bed, and I was like, "We're gonna name it Rex." Yeah. And she still has it, and it goes with her everywhere. And you guys have all met Rex because of this. Everyone,
I do
Rex
love
now.
Robert Englund in the first part where he comes out as Freddy and takes all that shot. It's really fun.
It's good.
It's a smart movie.
It's a very smart film. Babadook still holds up. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I had seen it since I saw an early screening of it. Still holds up really well. New Blood, it doesn't hold up for me as much. I think it's kind of silly and boring. Demons, fantastic film.
Always
fantastic. Although it does hit a moment where it's just kind of like it goes in a very repetitive motion where it's like, we don't know where else to go with this. We've already introduced the punks. Let's keep running down hallways.
But with that music, it doesn't matter. Greta, come on. It's so much fun.
I had a discussion with someone online if it needs a remake or if it's ripe for a remake. Like, could you remake Demons?
I always think Wreck fills that void.
It does.
Wreck really does fill that void.
Except the movie theater part is what I love about it. I love that self-reference.
I don't know if you could call them demons now because everyone associates demons like with hell. And in that, they have nothing to do with hell. They're just kind of like creatures.
What comes from that archaeological
thing? Transformative demons. Yeah. Like, we don't have enough of those kind of horror movies.
We really haven't seen teeth being pushed out of gums
and fangs being
there. We had like Night of the evil. Demons and then Demon Knights, but we don't have, transformative demons. We haven't seen in a really long time.
No, they're often like shades of zombies, basically. Yeah. Yeah. Which is
bring it back, Tarek.
Yeah.
Okay. Hellraiser still holds up. I saw it at Beyond Fest. Fantastic screening.
Still holds up. That's an understatement. It's like a flat-out
Well, it was interesting. interesting because somebody actually went on my Instagram and said something in effect like, just recently saw it. Doesn't hold up that much. No, it does.
Yeah, that's crazy.
They're wrong.
The Omen, 1976, fantastic movie. Scream 2.
You know, yeah. I have to go back to The Omen for a sec because I'm moving next. We do. Okay. We do. Because I'm currently, I'm moving next week. So I've been packing up all my books and I have this book called 1983 called The 50 Worst Movies Ever Made. And I kept it because it was like one of the first books where people talked about cult films. It was like one of the earliest ones where people were like, you know, Beast of Yucca Flats, this is a cult film. So it was like really early kind of cult theory. But in this book of the worst films ever made, he lists The Omen.
Of the worst movies ever
made? The worst movies ever made. And he lists
Somebody could say the movie's like overrated or something if they didn't like it, but you couldn't say worst doesn't even make sense. No.
Well, I mean, worst in general.
It's Richard Donner. Dick Donner don't make worst movies.
No,
even
sorry.
Superman 2, come on.
And I mean, Elric, you made the point that if it was the worst movie, no one would have ever heard of it.
Right, they wouldn't talk. It'd be a boring movie.
That said, even considering, even like calling that a bad film, I feel
pressed. No, that's weird.
Yeah.
It's a very serious film. It's part of that adult horror tradition, which I think is rare and great, you know?
Yeah.
It's not as good as The Changeling or something. It's not as unique in a sense.
Yeah.
It's a little more classic.
Well, when you weigh The Omen against something like Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist, The Omen is junk food.
Yeah.
It's very pure popcorn kind of entertainment.
And yet it's cool because you have like Gregory Peck in it. Like, so it elevates it at the time. And,
he's fantastic.
Trying to kill your own son is a pretty subversive idea. I like it.
I followed up with Scream 2.
Yes.
Hugh Brennan. All right, let's let Brennan in on it.
Which I said is on par with Scream, and I still stand by
it. Okay.
No.
You are both nutty people.
Still on par with Scream.
Both of you. I'd say one
sequel.
Notch down.
Why?
Because, I mean, first of all.
Why? Because it's a sequel?
No, because the plot is kind of incoherent in the second act. It's like all these people are happening and then it just doesn't make sense in the second part of it. And then it skips the end, which is hilarious and great. No.
I thought the opening scene's great. That's the one part of that movie I like. I haven't seen it recently.
Randy on the phone is great.
It's still a heartbreaker.
I was obsessed with that too. I made a point to watch all the movies that he mentions in his monologue during that scene.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah,
maybe you two should start your own podcast.
it'll be all about slasher movies.
I
could do that.
Yeah, Brennan's a slasher expert.
Yeah. I think the movie's fantastic. I loved all the layers they added to it. I love the Cotton Weary approach. I love everything just collides.
Is that the one with Timothy Oliphant?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay.
And they throw in, you know, Mrs. Loomis.
Speaking of the second act, Timothy Oliphant vanishes from that movie.
He does, because he's doing shit, but whatever.
No, look, for
something tells me you like it the most because of the Fright Night connection. That's all there is. That's my guess.
No,
it's a Fright Night thing.
What are you talking about, Fright Night?
Think about the ending of the movie. Major Fright Night connector.
Urban Legend, Urban Legend, which I watched last night, which is the week of recording.
Nice.
I haven't seen Urban Legend since it came out on VHS.
Yeah, I don't think
I gave it a real hard time. And then halfway through the movie, I was like, all right, I'm lukewarm on the movie. I don't hate the movie. I'm lukewarm on the movie. And then my girlfriend and I started doing Rebecca Gayhart fun facts.
Wait, excuse me, Ryan. Marital, please. Oh, you mean your fiance?
My fiance, yes.
Carry on, sir. Carry on. Carry on.
Right.
In case she's listening.
Changes.
Yes. Sorry, honey. no, we started like looking up like where they've been at, where have they gone? So we were like, where's Rebecca Gayhart? Oh.
Do you know what happened to her?
Oh, that happened.
What happened?
She hit a baby too.
She hit a kid. Yeah. Well, no. Well, the funny thing is we did the Pacey and then Rebecca Gayhart.
Oh, nice. Feature. Perfect. Yeah.
Wait, what?
Her and Brett Ratner were, I think, making out of cars.
Rebecca Gayhart hit
the car went onto a sidewalk.
It was a left-hand turn lane. Basically,
I remember when
it was a stoplight. Somebody was stopping. Somebody was jaywalking. This little boy was jaywalking. And what happened? The little boy jaywalked. Traffic had stopped. She went around the traffic because she thought there was just a fucking somebody stopping. And she went into a left-hand turn lane. The little boy was walking across the street.
You can't even visualize that.
No, it's very tragic and very unfortunate because Rebecca Gayhart, I mean, she was on the rise. She was doing the Noxzema commercial. Her film career was budding. Anyways, Urban Legend. Really silly movie. Love the concept of it. Great opening. Great ending. Everything else in the middle.
And it doesn't
really
do urban legends. That's the problem with it. It doesn't feel like it.
Elric, what are you talking about?
It just doesn't satisfy that.
Are you kidding? Those are perfect. They
succumb to the promise of the urban legend thing. I mean, it's so much so that they have fucking old tome from the library. It says Encyclopedia of Urban
Legends.
That's
why it's so stupid.
My memory is that, because I haven't seen that one in a long time, but I have the Blu-ray, so I'm going to check it out again. But I kind of like the second one a little better, if I remember correctly.
Everybody says that. I got to rewatch the second one.
And the only, the main reason, and I don't want to spoil it if you haven't seen it, is because of the end. And because I just don't buy the explanation they give.
Wait, hold on.
Yes.
That movie gets points because it's the only slasher where the killer gives a PowerPoint presentation about their motive.
Well, you know, and thank you for bringing that up, because I see that and all I think of is Adam's Family Values.
Okay.
With what's her name? Joan Cusack saying, and that's why I didn't get my Malibu Barbie, and that's why I'm doing all this. And it's like, that's all I see when I see the ending of Urban Legend. I'm like, so oh, good. God. Okay.
Eva Longoria anyway. Is in Urban Legends, isn't she?
Wait, really?
No. Sorry, Eva Mendez.
Yeah, that's right.
Eva Mendez.
Jared Leto.
Michael Rosenbaum with hair.
Oh, yeah.
Jared Leto hid in the backseat of someone's car for 2 weeks to prepare for that role.
Directed by John Ott, the Aussie composer. Yeah, he's a composer on a bunch of stuff. And an editor, I think.
Anyways, I think it's time to turn tonight after this recording. I think it's time to turn away from 90s slasher movies and kind of go back into some classics. So I'm going to pick something out of the blue, but I have no rhyme or reason behind my selections.
Okay.
Like That's the cool. other night, I was going like, I want to watch Attack the Block. And then I was like, oh, Urban Legend. So,
all right. Attack the Block holds up a bit better, I'm guessing.
Urban Legend. Yeah. Or yeah, Attack the Block. So, yeah.
Becca, what did you see?
I watched Death Stalker.
Stalker?
Death Stalker.
I see things haven't changed while I was gone.
You said that as if it defeated you.
It tracks, right? It tracks. No, it did defeat me, okay. And I ended up tweeting about this. So
it's rough, man.
I watched Death Stalker 1, and I was like, I don't know why I'm doing this. But then I had made it through Death Stalker 1, so I was like—
I'm looking at Becca's notes while she says that, and I can't wait for what's to come.
And so then I'm like, I'm going to watch Death Stalker 2. And then by this time, it was like 9:30, and I had this like cathartic moment where I'm like, why am I watching Deathstalker 2? I have things to do. And I didn't make it to Deathstalker 3 or 4. I had lofty ambitions of going through all four movies.
Weak,
I know.
So disappointed.
So the first one, I used to love this movie when I was a kid. This is like one of those films where like I would watch this when I was a kid and I thought it was this amazing adventure movie. And I remember the effects being really cool and it having like amazing monsters and all this stuff. So it was Corman produced it. He made the film in Argentina and he cast this beefy blonde dude as Deathstalker. And Deathstalker's mission is kind of confusing to begin with. Like a witch comes to him and is like, you must collect like an amulet, a cup, and some other item, and then you'll get all of this power.
That's what happens.
And yeah, it's what happens when you collect these three items. And then, but I mean, the guy who's playing Deathstalker is like the least emotive person in the entire world. And so it literally, he's like this surfer dude shoved into like this sword and sorcery movie where everyone else is like British and very Lord of the Rings style and overacting, and then he's just like, yeah, whatevs, it's cool, yeah, like I'll go get your cup and whatnot, and that's his attitude through the whole movie. And I would expect him, since he's supposed to be the hero who's saving the realm and getting all this power and collecting all these objects and defeating evil, you would expect him to be the good guy and moralistic and have, you know, kind of like superhero morals. Nope. He's like a rapey asshole. Yeah. He's just, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, I was not amused.
That took a turn.
It did. It did. And then the only thing that I remembered from my childhood that I still like, there's this little creature that the evil guy, this little creature that he keeps in the box and he feeds eyeballs to, and then occasionally it'll come out and he'll like tickle the little monster's chin, and that thing was still cool. So then I watched Part 2 from 1987, which was directed by Jim Wynorski, and on par with most Jim Wynorski films. A lot more boobs, a lot less plot than the first one. And so my childhood was a little crushed on the Deathstalker series. There were some amusing parts to it. If you're into your sword and sandal movies, it definitely is like a sword and sandal meets horror. Some of the effects are good. Some of them did not look as good on my TV as I recall them on VHS.
That is the gamble you take when you go back to things you loved as a kid.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Sometimes you never know.
And like Dave had never seen this before, and we're halfway through the first one, and he literally just looks at me and goes, why the fuck did you like this? And I'm like, I don't know. No, it
I was
is
young.
Great.
Should have stuck
young.
With Crawl 3D, baby.
Crawl 3D.
That's where it's at. Not a good
3D movie.
I watched a few other things, but we'll circle back to me. But yeah, the Deathstalker series.
I got one last thing,
What about me?
Okay,
go ahead.
Brennan, what'd you watch?
You go next.
You watch?
I just wanted to
Brennan, you're here with professionals. Okay, we do this for a living. Don't think we're going to forget about it.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just really wanted to talk about Cult of Chucky.
Okay,
I don't want spoilers because I'm still waiting.
No, I never do.
But okay. I saw it already.
No, I know. I've been listening to your show, and I want to talk.
All right, let's talk about it, man.
No, I got to take my boyfriend to the LA premiere because we're super cool. I saw Ryan there for 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
How did it play with an audience? Because I kind of wish I saw it that good. Way.
I mean, it really helps if Jennifer Tilly is in the audience, but it played super well. Don Mancini is really coming into his own as a director.
Yeah.
Like, he's only directed Chucky movies and Seed of Chucky, right?
Yeah. Did he direct any Hannibal? Did he ever get to direct?
I don't know. He didn't direct the show.
Movie wise, at least, it's only been Chucky as far as I know.
Yeah, it's only been Chucky movies. Yeah. Huh.
But like, the leap from Seed to Curse is such an enormous leap in directorial finesse. And this one, I wouldn't say is such a huge leap, but he's really got this brilliant, like, Universal-esque over design on the sets. It's a gorgeous movie.
Yeah.
And it's funny and it's gory and it's maybe 10 minutes too long for me, but I have a short attention span. But I loved it. It was so fun.
I haven't seen the one before, so I'm waiting. I'm going to do them all leading up. So
okay.
Definitely in October. I'm doing all of them in October. I just haven't started yet.
That's going to be a blast.
You've got to.
Yeah.
And also really quick, I have a blog. Welcome to Hollywood, I guess. Yeah. but I've been marathoning all the Amityville films for October.
Oh, bless you.
Oh my God. How far along are you?
I got to the remake and I stopped.
Wait, but you made it through all of those
sequels? Did. I watched 9 Amityville movies.
Wait, The Clock and The Dollhouse?
Yeah.
And, oh, my God.
What about the fourth one that's the Canadian one with
Evil Escapes with Patty Duke?
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah.
Ryan just came back in, so I have to fill him in. Brennan has been marathoning all the Amityville movies, like including The Doll
and
The Clock.
He made it to the remake.
God.
Which is 10 movies in.
I've committed some sins and I wanted to punish myself.
Any gems in there? Any surprising ones? But anything that will surprise us in there?
I did want to say Amityville 7, A New Generation, pretty solid.
Okay.
Really?
I mean, I'm saying this from someone who really liked Candyman 3, Day of the Dead.
Yeah. Oh, man. Now I cannot trust you at all.
No, I know.
Wait a second, what?
Two, Farewell to the Flesh, I understand, but three. Yeah. That's
no, in terms of 90s direct-to-video sequels, it's pretty solid. And I think it's all due to one person. And it's the casting director, Annette Benson. She did Elm Street. She did Night of the Comet. And the cast in this movie is great. Lynn Shea is in it in a pretty good,
You're on Amityville, not Candyman.
Amityville 7.
Right.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
We're back. All right, good.
David Naughton from American Werewolf in London is in
that
it.
That one. Terry O'Quinn?
Yeah, Terry O'Quinn
that
is in it.
That is the good one.
That's a good cast already. I've never seen this one.
Shaft is in it, whatever
Richard
his name
Roundtree?
Is. Yeah, Richard Roundtree is in it.
Yeah.
It's basically, oh, God. Okay, imagine the character, like the bohemian characters from Rent. Put the hairstyles from Friends onto them and put a haunted mirror in their loft. It's a great movie.
Brendan, you're never coming back. This is your one and only chance on the show.
No, Brendan, I'm impressed and I'm seeing this
I want to burn bright and fast and shocked.
I love it. I appreciate that.
His mind has been warped and he's not thinking straight.
Amityville 7.
I'm actually going to watch that based on your recommendation.
A New Generation.
There's a triple feature on DVD with three of these sequels, including that one.
Okay.
So for you, I'm curious, where was the quality dip for you?
Part one.
Oh, I like one.
Well, because two is better than one.
But I like three.
Honestly, for me, because like you said, I'm a little twisted. One, two, three were a step up each for me. Because part one should not be 2 hours long, and it's really bound to the in quotes true facts of the case. And true life is not as interesting as crazy batshit goblin monsters.
Yeah.
So two and three are much more interesting to me because they kind of shake loose and kind of delve into fiction a little more and not, oh, this guy was mean to his kids and then they left a house.
Yeah.
Three is so boring.
I love three.
Yeah, I think three is boring.
Meg Ryan.
I think
awesome.
Three is kind of
me and Eric watched it in.
It's not even in the house.
And you and I watched it in 3D and it was still boring.
Yeah, it was only that little ending that kind of got it. I think two is unquestionably the most fun of those
movies.
I think
there's one effective scene in three, which is when they pull the girl from the water.
Yes, that seems incredible.
And then she's like walking up the stairs. It's a good scene.
That's a good scene.
But then there's like, isn't there a haunted workplace scene where something at his workplace and you're like, come on, this is about a house. Like, I don't care about your workplace. I don't know.
Okay, no, that is true. The house is the most important aspect of that because it's such a beautiful production design, and the films lose the house and get progressively worse. But yeah, part seven's all right.
Thanks for going deep for us because I'm glad. You don't have to.
Are you
going to
check out the new one, which comes out this month?
Yes.
Really?
You're going to go for it.
Are there
any after the remake?
Well, the thing is, in 2011, I think they realized that you can't copyright the name Amityville.
Oh, yes.
So there's been like one or two per year since then that
aren't officially part of the thing.
I'm not going to pay
Not part of the actual franchise, technically.
Yeah, I mean, what is part of the actual franchise? Nobody knows.
Yeah.
But I watched the nine between the original and the remake.
I think I've said this.
You deserve a shirt for that.
I know. Well,
Thank you.
I think I said this on the show before, but it was hilarious. I had talked to you. David Bruckner was going to direct an Amityville at some point.
Right.
He called me up because I'm from Long Island and I know the real Amityville and I've seen all the movies. And basically he's like, do I need to see all the movies before I do this? And I'm like,
no.
Nope. You just need a house and it's haunted and it's Amityville and it's got the windows. Yeah. Like, kind of don't need to see the other nine movies.
I thought that documentary was pretty interesting about the sun, the real sun.
Yeah, that documentary.
I mean, it's sad.
Could be the scariest.
My Amityville horror.
Yeah, I found that to be quite disturbing, actually.
Yeah.
The clock one's pretty good, too.
I don't mind the clock one.
That's funny.
Yeah.
All right, well, I got a couple more.
Wait, no, Rob's hasn't
gone. Oh, Rob.
I got one last one.
I'm so sorry,
go, go,
Rob.
Go.
But all right, I'll do this one because I've been dying to talk to you guys about it. I was going to give you all this quality time at the end, but that's okay.
I'm so sorry. I have one that I think should be the end cap.
Okay, fine.
Because I am in charge of this episode.
You're in charge.
You guys gave me I want producer credit.
You did actually come up with all our topics.
You
so
did.
I will give you full credit. Just don't ruin this one for me, Rob,
because I just got it from, and it's sitting on my bench.
Okay, all right.
So don't ruin this puppy.
I will try to be as clear as possible about this. Severin Films, because only they would do this, have released a movie by Lucio Fulci that I've never heard of.
No one had.
From 1986 called The Devil's Honey.
What the best cover
ever.
Ryan smiling.
So
have you seen this
No,
yet?
I'm smiling because when I was packing to leave, my fiance goes, oh, I see you got movies. The Devil's Honey. I had it right on top. I was like, wow. This is something I need to watch by myself.
Yeah, yeah. Let me tell you, yes, that is absolutely true. That's number one. It was just funny because Jackson Stewart was trying to describe it to me the day. He's like, I can't get it out of my mind. And I'm like, wow, okay. And so I sat down and watched it. This movie, this is all I'm going to tell you. This movie is Fulci attempting to make 9.5 weeks complete with a Italian Mickey Rourke lookalike who plays saxophone and is probably the most terrifying thing he's ever made.
The cover.
Oh, shit.
Looks his, 9.5 weeks.
Well, no, it's not scary. It's just his idea of sex and lust are the most terrifying, most inappropriate things I've ever seen in my life. And so the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, Jackson described the saxophone. So.
I can only tell you the.
I'm showing Becca the key art where the guy's playing this, playing a saxophone.
Into her crotch.
That's in the opening 5 minutes. Just so you know.
He is literally playing a saxophone into her crotch, like her crotch. Is sitting in the saxophone.
There is no time wasted. And in fact,
saxophone
within that first 5 minutes, I just love this like Mickey Rourke looking dude that plays saxophone. Within the first 5 minutes, he's like recording and like everyone steps out of the studio and he decides to play. Well, actually he tries to have sex with her, and then when she's like, no, this isn't the right time, he instead plays saxophone into her private
regions. Look who
regions.
She looks like, Kane.
Isabella Johnson.
She looks like Isabella Johnson.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And so this is very highly inappropriate and very awkward to watch.
By yourself?
Yes, it's even awkward by yourself. And then there is no sexual harassment.
Yeah.
Then there's a total turn for the second half of the movie, which I don't think it's a spoiler, but basically that lead female character is kind of just like naked and torturing a dude for the second half.
Oh.
And it's like,
plot twist.
What is this? What did I stumble onto? But it's just hilarious trying to see Fulci reinterpret 9.5 weeks.
And he did quite a few erotic films. I haven't seen
it. You know who the lead
non-erotic.
Is? It's the girl from The Story of O.
Oh, so that's why it's an erotic.
Yeah.
This is the most excited
I've ever been about a movie. Like, I've got it sitting on my shelf, and I'm like, oh, I can't wait to watch this.
Just wait. Severin, bless you for finding yet another film I've never heard of that is just so off the wall and not appropriate in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, well, this came up, and pristine quality, of course. I don't usually plug the other podcast, but I will plug because Jackson was on it talking about this movie, and I think it's one of the best we've ever done because we'd want to do something different than what we do here. So I was like, oh, let's do horror triple features for October.
Great episode,
and there's some
so
pretty
good.
Fucking funny. Like we really put a lot of thought into the ridiculousness of some of those lists, and Jackson the whole time could only talk about the devil, like off air. You go, dude, I have to tell you about the Devil's Honey.
I cannot wait to watch this movie.
So that's we're all saying.
one more forever changed.
One more, just quickly. It was played at the Shudder. Does the free room at Beyond Fest?
Oh yeah.
There's a film called Better Watch Out, which will tick a whole lot of people's boxes around here who are Christmas horror nuts. It's an interesting movie. You know, I think I'm going to have the opposite reaction of a lot of people because I read a lot of reviews where like, oh, it's kind of boring at start, and then it makes a big turn, and then I really love this movie. And I was like the total opposite, which is I really like the setup, and I was totally into this movie. Like, oh, I'm going to love this movie. And then where the movie went, I was like, oh. And you know, so I'm not going to – I definitely don't want to spoil this because there are some fun movements and twists in it. But I think I'll be really curious to hear your thoughts on it.
I saw people talking about it. It's on Amazon for rent, and I will rent it. But there's something inappropriate about watching anything Christmas-related now.
Yeah.
So it's like – I like, nope.
It's very weird that it's out now. I saw it on iTunes.
No, like, after Halloween,
I think
I'll
Thanksgiving,
watch it.
Yeah. Like we're putting that right after Thanksgiving. But the lead
actress –
that's
when I'll watch it.
The lead actress is really excellent in this film. I think she does a really fantastic – the lead guy is great too, but it's a little more obvious. She's just actually really, to me, the glue of this one. I liked it. It's one of those films that makes bold choices. And so you're either going to be with those or you're not. And but I like the setup in it. And it's part of the Christmas canon. I think it will fit in nicely for people. Nice. And they have snow, Becca.
They have snow.
The one effect none of you California Christmas horror.
Snow.
You and Brian Yuzna. Brian Yuzna, he couldn't get snow.
We did not
Silent
put
Night
snow
3.
Which is funny because they shot it in Australia.
Really?
Yes.
And
on a soundstage,
we
too.
Felt weird that there was no snow, so we actually make a point in the film to say this is Southern California and it's like 75 degrees. So
You're part of a tradition.
Yes.
There's a few of them.
All right, Becca and Brennan.
Yeah, so I watched two other things that I'll quickly talk about.
And
The Ghoul.
Oh, I
watched
The Ghoul.
Yeah, so I'd gotten a screener for this one a couple of weeks ago, and I checked it out. Arrow Films, produced by Ben Wheatley. And I have to say, even though that it kind of looks horror-y and you think that the setup is horror, it does not shake out to be a horror film. It shakes out to be something a little bit more, I'll call it psychological thriller. That said, it was really slow, and I do have to, when I say slow burn, it was slow burn, but I kind of liked where it went enough to keep me in through the whole thing. And I liked the ending. There were parts that I was like, man, that got meandering. But I felt like it needed to be streamlined a bit more, but I really did enjoy it. So the whole concept is this police officer is investigating a crime, and the crime is pretty much like two people got shot, but as best they can tell, they kept walking around for a little bit after they were shot in the head. Mm. And so then he's investigating kind of how this happened, and it leads him to the psychologist. So he decides to go undercover, and this all happens in the first 10 minutes. He decides to go undercover as a patient at this psychologist, thinking that she may have something to do with it because they were both patients of hers. And then it kind of goes from there. And yeah, it's directed by this guy named Gareth Tunley. I had not seen any of his stuff. This may actually be one of his first feature films. Produced by Ben Wheatley, whose stuff I had enjoyed before. And yeah, it's slow. Don't expect it to be like a fast pace. Like I thought reading the back, I was like, oh, this is going to be like a horror murder mystery. Does not shake out like that in any accord. But psychological thriller, really slow, really brooding. I kind of liked it. Yeah. And then I also watched Deep Rising because it was my birthday.
It was my birthday every year.
No, Dave literally said on my birthday, he was like, so do you want to go like get some like katsuya? He was going to take me to like the fancy sushi place. And I was like,
listen, Becca, it's going to be a real fancy night. We're going to do some katsuya. We're going to get a little treat Williams.
Yeah, no. He was like ready, do you want to go to like a show or we could go to like Beyond Fest and we could get like some nice sushi beforehand? And I was literally like, can't we just get a birthday cake from Ralph's and I can wear pajamas and we can watch Deep Rising? And he was like, yeah, we can do that too. And so literally we went to Ralph's, we bought one of those like, I call them Crisco cakes, but like those like inch thick frosting monstrosities
that turn your tongue black.
Yes.
Blue.
Oh my God. It's
Becca
just
can
like,
live it up, right?
It is literally like one slice and just coronary on a platter. And I was like, I just want a slice of that. Let the kids have some. And then I'm watching Deep Rising, and we did. And I love that fucking movie no matter what.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Did you watch it on Blu-ray or did you watch it on, is it on iTunes?
It is.
Can I rent it?
It is on Amazon because I actually own the, nice. I keep like Deep Rising is one where I will always buy the latest edition of it. But because we're moving, I have it packed right now. So when I was like, I want to watch it again, we had to rent it off of Amazon. But then when I was doing that, I realized I rented it last year as well.
Oh, so, Treat Williams is living on the hog to you, girl.
And I now have to say, like, look for my Halloween costume. It may be, no one else in the world is going to get it, but it may be Deep Rising.
I can't wait. I can't wait till you see your tentacles.
Yes. So that was my birthday Deep Rising.
Did Ryan have one?
I just had two. I saw two. Well, they were just like quick one-offs that were playing at Fantastic Fest. They came across my desk. One is called Anna and the Apocalypse, which is basically...
It's a musical!
It's a musical. It's Glee meets Shaun of the Dead set around Christmas.
Sold.
I will tell you
It's great.
It is a very feel-good kind of movie. It has some pacing issues, but goddamn, the music is very catchy. The next morning I woke up with like one of the main cafeteria songs in my head and I was like, goddamn, you musical. I usually don't like musicals because I hate joy, but this was actually pretty good. and then the other one that I saw, Revenge, which is a very hyper stylized, very slick, very effective, very well done rape revenge thriller by female director Coralie Fargeot. I'm mispronouncing her name.
Fantastic she's from France. Fest was doing it up, I remember.
Yeah, and she's basically, she's just got like after I saw High Tension, I was like, who is this? After seeing Revenge, I'm like, who the hell is this? I want to make movies with her. I think she's fantastic.
Wait, she had something to do with High Tension?
No. I just kind of like that from feeling. France, that kind of same vibe.
Extremism.
And, you know, basically the movie is a woman goes to this kind of like isolated desert retreat with her or with her boyfriend or with her boyfriend who's also married, and they have a, you know, they've just got a very steamy love affair, and then one day his two buddies show up knocking at the front door because they have a hunting trip planned, and of course two of the assholes take advantage of her. Her boyfriend doesn't really help matters, and next thing you know, she's going on a vicious revenge, very, very bloody and very, very effective and very cheerworthy revenge plan. It's really well done. I think, you know, obviously with these films, we talked about these couple of episodes again, you know, they're very uncomfortable, but, you know, the filmmaker kind of takes your hand and guides you through it without getting too exploitive. Mm. It kind of mostly all happens off camera. Mm. So once you've gotten through that, you can follow her journey without feeling too, you know, unsettled. But the lead is so good. She's so awesome. And the things that she does are so amazing that by the end I was kind of like, oh, I forgot how this all began. You know, you kind of like forget how it all began. And you're just like with her. But, you know, really impressive debut. Shudder bought it.
Oh, cool. So we'll be able to see it soon.
You're going to be able to see it soon. So put that on your radar. Revenge. Really fantastic. Really well done film.
Sounds like Twitter. brutal and ugly, just like
Twitter. Wow.
Christ, yeah. No, this has been a rough week, man.
Okay.
All right.
It really does.
Well, pick that up, Brennan.
Okay, well, somebody get the number for the Horror Police on speed dial, because this one's a little iffy. But I was doing research about our topic today.
Okay.
I actually just watched Friday the 13th Part 2 with my 14-year-old cousin yesterday morning, because he's super excited about the game, and I've been showing him the movies. It's really great. But I was thinking about Tom McBride, who plays the kid in the wheelchair, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
Who gets, you know, falls down the stairs and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
That actor is gay. And I knew that he had passed away of complications to AIDS in the mid-90s.
Huh.
But what I didn't know was that there was a documentary about him.
Whoa.
It's 50 minutes long. It's called Life and Death on the A-List. And the A-List is referring to the gay A-List and not the movie's A-List.
Yeah, right?
But it's basically because he's an incredibly handsome, very muscular man. And it's
hell of an arm wrestler.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He plays for position.
In that one, yeah.
But
nice.
It's screening for free online in a lot of different sources on the official website and on Vimeo. It's very amateurishly made because it was the mid-90s on a camcorder and the titles look like Windows Movie Maker titles. But the thing is, because of that, it has this raw realism to it. It's just these kind of presented out of sequence, like kind of contextless interviews with Tom McBride, like in the months leading to his death and during his slow decline to a degenerative brain disease as he slowly becomes paralyzed on one side and then the other.
Oh my God.
Oh, wow. This sounds heavy.
It's the first half is very much about the gay culture in the 80s and 90s. And then the second half is very much about his death and kind of the death of that culture.
Was he in other stuff?
like four minor roles after and then that? Commercials. Okay. Then he became a photographer, like an erotic gay photographer. Uh-huh. There's a lot of dong in because it shows his photos.
Hashtag lot of dong.
So basically, dong spoiler.
It's this raw, like on the ground document of like one gay man's life in New York as it's fading, and it really hits you, and it's really bleak, but it's also super interesting, and it's also not afraid to not make him look like an angel. He's a very flawed human being, even though he's like very charming and charismatic and by all accounts very nice. Like the way he's viewing the world is kind of warped, and it's really interesting, and it's 50 minutes.
And what's
I watched
it
this morning. It's called Life and Death on the A-List, and there's one shot in the hospital that is beautifully composed. I don't know how it happened, but it's literally his family on a couch kind of trying to babble to themselves and just talking about normal things. And he's reflected in a mirror behind them, just coughing in his hospital bed.
Jesus. Oh, man.
Sorry, I don't want to bring the tone down, but it was really interesting, even though it's not spectacularly well made. It's very low rent.
But the emotion is there.
Yeah, the emotion
even
is
though
100%
there. The technology or whatever they needed to tell the story wasn't.
Yeah, and it's short. It goes in and out real fast.
Right.
Sorry, you go.
No, I was just going to say it's always fascinating to me because like people like that who never got to see the kind of popularity that, I mean, he probably thought Friday the 13th too was just whatever.
No, I do think so.
Gig. And like, you know, because a lot of people were so surprised with kind of the way fan culture has evolved over the years with conventions and these documentaries about the making of these franchises, stuff like that. So I was, you know, like last week when, Keira was talking about her book, her first book about that.
Oh, yeah, the actor.
Italian actor that died before she finished the book and thought nobody cared. I don't know. I always think that's kind of sad too.
Yeah.
Like if only he knew how big a deal that franchise was.
This is very much like that because there is a part where he is talking about his career and how it never really went anywhere and kind of lamenting that.
I will plug, there was a podcast this week called it's a podcast been going for a long time called Wrong Reel, and sometimes they do hard ones. They did all Friday 13th films in a row this week, and when they touched on that one, they actually, I really like the way they put it. They're like, you know what's interesting is they build up his character arm wrestle after arm wrestle. He's just like a champion and you're building up his like sexual thing with this girl and you're all really excited, and then Jason shows up and just fucks him up so fast. They build it up like he would be a character who could like actually fight back even though he's in a wheelchair, and then Jason just does not give a shit, and the way Jason dispatches him, it really is like a watermark moment for that character to be like just what Jason is as a killing machine. And they put it really well, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. So it's just weird simpatico that you're now talking about the tail end of that. You know,
I need to go back and watch the movie again.
It's one of the best slasher movies.
Yeah.
It's a really strong slasher. Yeah,
my cousin really liked it, for the record.
That's good.
He's 14. So it's holding out.
Nicely done.
Nice. Alrighty, so
let's bring in our guest.
Get our guest, yeah.
In need of great talent for your business but on short time? You don't need to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click, so you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them.
No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find a qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/shock. One more time, go and try it for free today.
ZipRecruiter.com/shock. Wonder Twins activates. All right. So we've got a very special guest on for this episode. I am very, very thrilled to have on director, colleague, friend, Christopher Landon, who has a film out today called Happy Death Day.
Shit. This is the way to spend your Friday 13th, folks.
Yes. I mean, it's a great time. Go see Currently fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm very excited about this.
Let's hope it stays there.
Wait a minute. Let's ask the one non-person involved with that's not involved with Bumass at all to comment. Elric Kane.
Yes.
Go ahead. What's your review of Happy Death Day?
Paranormal Activity Mark Ones is the fucking bomb. Yes. I truly love it. Which I've told on the show many times, actually, so I'm not just making that up. I keep wanting to call it Super Happy Death Day. I don't know why.
That's the anime version?
That is the anime version.
I think the trailer, you know what's cool about it is so often I feel like trailers miss kind of read a movie and maybe push it. I feel like this trailer completely gets to the heart without ruining it, completely gets to heart what the movie is. And sure. I wanted to see it on the trailer basis. And my wife, who's not a horror person, wanted to see it on the trailer basis. She has the 80s nostalgia bug.
Right.
And so she loved it on that front. And we just sat there and made our day better. We enjoyed it.
We had a lot of fun with it.
Chris is part of the Blumhouse family. You were part of the Paranormal Activity franchise.
Wrote a ton of them.
Yes.
All of them except one. Is that right?
That is.
Holy cow.
Two.
I didn't write the first one, and I didn't write the Ghost Dimension. Oh.
But you directed.
It's okay. You didn't miss too much.
But you wrote and directed Paranormal Activity, the Marked Ones.
Yep.
And then you also directed Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, which I keep trying to refer
it's
to
fun.
As Scouts versus Zombies.
Yeah.
And who did the effects on that movie? Scouts?
It was
Tony Gardner.
Oh,
okay, yes. Oh, that's
it. It was meant to be a quick response, exciting thing, but I think I just fucked it up.
I didn't know if you were talking practical or visual, and I got confused.
We only talk Tony Gardner effects here. We all love him.
We love Tony.
Tony is the best. He also created our mask.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
It's the first time I had ever seen a credit just for the mask creation.
Oh, that's cool. I don't think people know that at all. That's neat.
And that mask is really cool. It's genuinely frightening.
Well, where do we want to go? Because we have a lot to talk
about. Brennan has a great topic for the show. But,
yes.
Hello.
Hi, Brennan.
Brennan's still here. Kane didn't run him off yet.
Yeah.
Not yet.
But do we want to talk a little bit about the film?
Yeah, let's start with the film.
Yeah.
I think so.
And then I think it makes sense to go into kind of our Chris got into this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
For our topic. So, yeah, I mean, you know what's funny is this is the concept that I think everyone – it's like, why didn't I do that first? Which is basically like, why didn't they do Groundhog Day as like a horror movie? And I've heard of several similar projects around town for the last several years, and none of them, for whatever reason, have gained traction or gotten together. So for you, how did this happen, and why was this kind of formula the one that made it work?
We have to go back like 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Universal had the script, which back then was called Half to Death. And it was written by Scott Lobdell, who's a comic book writer. And they brought me on to rewrite his script. And they had a director attached at the time. And I read the script and I loved the concept. I loved the whole scary version of Groundhog Day. But I told the studio at the time, I said, because they said, oh, well, just do a dialogue polish. And I said, no, this needs a lot more than a dialogue polish, because it had repetitive kills and the characters weren't fleshed out and it wasn't taking advantage of the concept enough. And so I said, if you let me just do a huge page one rewrite, then I'll do this job. And so they said, all right, go ahead and do it. And I rewrote the script. The director hated my script. He was like, I want to go back to the old script. And then they shut the project down. And then it was going to be a Rogue movie for Universal at the time. And then Rogue folded.
Vanished.
And so the script just kind of got put on a shelf. And then 8 years later, I was having lunch with one of the producers, Angela Mancuso. And she said, whatever happened to Happy Death Day? The other title. And that's when the light bulb turned on. And so I called Ryan and I called Jason and I said, you guys should check this out. And everybody read it and they dug it. And then next thing I knew, we were kind of like flying into production. And I ended up doing some more rewrites after that, but it was pretty quick.
Did much change from your original rewrite like 8-9 years ago to now, or was basically the slasher kind of conceit?
That stayed generally the same. There weren't any major changes. I wanted to really push the love story a bit more. We have a different ending, as you guys know.
Talked about it off record.
but there were some changes, and then I made a lot of I added a couple characters, and then just dialogue stuff. But the bulk of it stayed the same.
Right. And what about to me, you guys mentioned Tony Gardner before. To me, the I think it's probably the most important aspect of doing this kind of movie is locking the mask. You hear all the stories about the Friday 13th franchise and obviously Scream and stuff like that. Right. So did you have anything in mind when you wrote it compared to what ended up being the kind of the cherub baby mask?
It was completely different. And I, at the time, didn't change the mask. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Scott had written like a panther.
It was a mascot. It was like a
panther mascot. And then when shit got real and I realized, oh, we're going to actually make this, I knew I had to figure out a real mask, like something that would actually be scary and be effective and still work as a mascot, but also be something that you are terrified of when it's chasing you. I think at the time when we were in early prep, I was also expecting my first child.
Oh wow.
And so I think I had like baby on the brain. And I was like, I'm afraid of babies.
The fear is real.
Yeah. So I think that was kind of where the idea was percolating. And then I started, Googling and looking at pictures of all things like weird and creepy and baby, and saw some stuff out there. So I called Tony up and said, will you help me make a mask? And I said, I think this is one direction, the baby. And then I said, maybe let's try and figure out a pig. Because I also thought that like it spoke to Tree's character, that she was a selfish pig. Mm-hmm. And I could buy that as a mascot too. So Tony went off and he made two prototypes. And then he sent them to me in my office in New Orleans. And then it was like Christmas. I opened the box and I was like, oh my God. and so I put on the baby mask and I snuck into our line producer's office and I crept up behind him and tapped him on the shoulder and he turned around and he screamed so loud and ran so fast out of the room. And I was like, this is the mask. This is definitely great.
You know what I love about the mask? He included teeth. Baby teeth are the weirdest thing. Like, creepy. I have an 18-month-old now, and I look at him all the time, and the teeth, they're like oversized, and they're spaced weird, and I just loved that it included the teeth.
Well, I remember you had sent us some tests. It was just like photographs, and it was just some rando person in a hoodie with a knife, and I was just like, oh yeah, because I remember you sending it over the pig, and I was like, it looks good, but he's got this smile. Cool. It was cool, but it wasn't the baby.
Didn't have the weirdness of the baby. And that's the thing that works so well, is that it's this very, like, in a different context, it's a very sweet, cute face. Mm-hmm. But, you throw a hoodie on it and give someone a knife, and it's not so cute anymore.
I like the cartoony quality. Yeah. And it matches that there's also a comic nature of the movie, not just a slash film, it's also a comedy.
And it had to speak to both.
Yeah. Because I remember, the only similar mask, which isn't that similar, but is Valentine, but that's like a so serious.
Yeah, it feels very Victorian looking. Yeah.
Well, it's also the celebration of birth and death, Elric.
Oh, what, Valentine?
Baby,
did you seriously just get allegorical about Valentine?
David Boreanaz film? Come on.
Love, death.
What about casting? Because I mean, like we were saying before you're on here, that to me is like, I feel like there's certain types of movies that maybe, I don't want to say they're more mainstream, but might appeal to the mainstream when they're horror comedies or these kind of movies, where I think usually that's where they fall apart. Like you'll watch it, it'll be an ensemble, it'll be like, yeah, they're fine TV actors, but it just never sings. And this movie is like, to me, built on these two just, wonderful performances, and you really root for them, and you actually really don't want the characters to die. And that's where I think we should always be positing slashers, and I'm never are. Usually it's somebody you like, fuck that person, and then they die,
Well, I mean, it's like a magic trick, because when you first meet a tree,
just like Groundhog
Day, you open the movie, you're definitely like, wow. Well, I thought like, wow, I'm really an old person. because I really hate this girl so much.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, that's kind of the arc of.
But the guy who is Israel Brozat, you know, you love
Carter,
him from you love him from like the first second. He just seems so amiable and real. He doesn't seem like he's full of shit, which is nice.
Yeah.
Did you get the kind of, for, you know, directors, casting is such a, you know, great part of the process. If you get to, how involved were you able to be?
I'm super involved with casting on every movie I do. I have, you know, like every filmmaker I think has to be aware of their strengths and their weaknesses. Casting is one of my true strengths.
Right. Yeah.
And I have this very gut level feeling when I meet actors. And sometimes it's I've had actors walk into the room and I knew right away. It's that love at first sight thing. And so with Tree, you know, we cast Jessica Roth, and she, you know, this is like an incredibly challenging, difficult role for an actor because she carries the whole movie. She's in every scene. She has to be a bitch. She has to be vulnerable and scared and emotional and funny.
Funny is tough.
Movies, I think. And so she kind of can do it all. And when I saw her audition, I knew right away that she was the one, and it was a taped audition.
Yeah.
But then we also Skyped, and there was this immediate rapport and this connection, and I knew that she was the right person for the role. And then with Israel, it was about, and it's funny, I saw a lot of qualities in Israel that I, funny enough, a long time ago saw in Shia LaBeouf when we cast him in Disturbia, which was he was a relatable guy. Like, I believed that guy. I knew him when I was in college. And what I wanted from Carter was for him to be that everyman, and for him to be a presence that kind of balanced the movie out, because she has to be so crazy all the time that it was nice that he was sort of this very stable, kind of cool, calm dude. And Israel embodies that. Like, when you meet this guy, like, he's just the nicest person on the planet. Like, he goes around with his fluffy dog Charlotte everywhere. Like, he has one of those the service dog things. So, like, we would go out to dinner and he would always have this little fluffy dog in his lap all the time. And so he's just a nice guy.
Yeah. One of those characters. I think he's one of my favorite characters. Of like kind of in the same way that you love Randy from Scream, or like, you know, like that kind of character, even though he's not like a horror.
There's
guy,
not
like,
an obnoxiousness to
him. No, there's like just Randy. There's something genuine. Like you immediately like, I like this kid.
What I wanted, and the way that I wrote it and what I wanted was like, I wanted to feel like I plucked him out of a John Hughes movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what I was really going for. And he fits that. Like, he is that guy.
All right. Let's make a John Hughes movie with him now. well, should we go back to the beginning? Do you want to take lead on some of the topics that you – I'm looking at Brandon. He looks like a deer in headlights right now. Well, let's go.
You must have been really young. I mean, and I'm not just saying this to blow smoke up your ass when you say, hey, somebody looks young. But you look to me like, looking at how all your credits, you look incredibly young to have had – the amount of credits you've had, like even going back to Disturbia.
Do you see the gray in this room?
You're gray.
But you're hiding it well. I mean, but how'd you get into filmmaking?
I always wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And it was like I was the kid that made little weird movies and with my video camera. And I made like a zombie sequel to Xanadu.
Oh my god.
Oh my
Brandon
god.
Brandon just lit up called? And so did Rob. You've got two huge Xanadu
fans.
I'm
not a musical fan, but Xanadu is by far one of my favorite movies.
I haven't seen Happy Death Day. I'm a civilian, but Xanadu's 2 I can get into.
Yeah. So this was it was Xanadu 2 Bloodlust.
Yes. Wow. Okay. Did ELO do the score?
I reached out to them. They weren't really available.
Okay.
But I did weird stuff like that. And then, and was writing and whatnot. And then when I was in college, I was in film school. And one summer I made a short film. And it got into some festivals and a producer saw it. And they approached me and asked me if I had any writing samples. And I had written some other rando script and gave it to them. And then they said, oh, Larry Clark, who directed the movie Kids, really liked your writing sample. And he wants to meet you. Wow. And I was like, "That's is this happening?
Yeah.
Another Day in Paradise, right?
Yeah. So, so I met with Larry and we got along great. And he was like, I want you to do this. And so the production company that was making the movie. They said, look, you know, you're nobody. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to let you write the first half of the script, which was based on a book. And if we like the first, you know, 50 pages that we get, then we'll make a deal with you. And then you'll actually get to sort of have a proper deal. Right. But if we hate him, then you just walk away and that's that. So there's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. That's
but yeah, but I ended up, you know, writing the whole movie, and that was the first movie that I got produced. I was 19 or 20.
Oh my goodness. Wow. So you were like still in film school.
I was in film school. Yeah.
Wow. Which here in LA.
Echoes Don Mancini from last week or 2 weeks ago or whenever Don Mancini was still in film school when he was, or in college when he was writing the first Chucky.
So I mean, which movie was that? Wild.
It was called Another Day in Paradise.
Wow.
And it was Vincent Gallo, James Woods.
Yeah. Melanie Griffith.
Yeah. It's a fun movie.
And it was a crazy experience, but I was so young, and then all of a sudden I had all these big talent agencies calling me, and I signed with an agency, and everybody was like, oh, this kid, like, he's so young, and you can, and I started to, basically the long story short is I totally shit the bed. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. And I panicked, and then when everything went south and my agency fired me, I just sort of packed it up and moved away.
Yeah.
And then what brought you back?
So I moved to Austin, Texas. And started looking into real estate. Like, I was like, oh, I guess I'll sell houses. Like, I don't know what else to do anymore. And I didn't know anybody when I moved there, and I was really lonely. And I ended up writing a TV pilot just for the hell of it. And it was about the Invisible Man.
Oh, cool.
But the point of view was more as a metaphor for feeling invisible, which is the way I felt at the time. And so I sent my script to a friend, and I said, will you read this and let me know if it sucks? And then I think a week later she called me and she was like, I sold it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, what? And she had sold it to CBS, and I moved back to LA to kind of keep, to, you know, start working on that. And then while I was working on that, I wrote Disturbia. And that was a spec. So I just kind of threw that out.
Wait, so was the your Invisible Man pilot the one that was the series that was on?
No, this was a different
incarnation.
Totally different thing.
Right.
And
did it ever get made?
No.
Okay.
Definitely didn't get made. It was a total bummer.
But Disturbia did.
But Disturbia did.
That was a huge hit.
Yeah.
How much
involvement did you get outside the script? Were you actually involved in that production?
I was not. Okay. I kind of got pushed aside.
Yeah.
Which was tough. But the movie turned out well, and I was really happy with it.
And is that where you then become into the Blumhouse family and start working?
Yeah. So that's, I met Jason kind of around that time, and I wrote another movie, for Jason and for Paramount, that I still to this day want to make, and I keep bugging everyone about it.
I know.
and then the whole paranormal thing was just a complete fluke situation for me as well, because I was not supposed to write any of those movies, and it was just a crazy happenstance kind of a thing.
But you didn't write Ghost Dimension.
No.
Good.
Leave Ghost Dimension alone. I know all the people that worked on that movie.
Can't. I just can't.
I like those people. It was a really tough situation.
Oh, okay.
So one question that we really like to ask on our show, Shockwaves, is as a horror fan, where did you get started? What was the first movie that really screwed you up? Like, how did you kind of get into the genre?
Right. So there are a couple sort of, I think, pivotal moments. The first one was my parents were watching Psycho in their room, and I snuck into their room without them knowing it and hid behind a chair and was watching it. And I managed to hold it together even through the shower scene. And I'm like 5, I think, or 6 years old. And the shower scene really scared me, but it was abstract enough to where I didn't fully get it. But then when Norman comes charging down the stairs after the skeleton, she turns the chair around, and we see his mother, and then he comes down the stairs with the wig on, I lost it. Like, just started screaming my head off and ran out of the room. And that was the first time where I felt both the sort of the charge and the excitement of a horror movie, but also just the abject terror. And then I think the next big moment for me was when I finally got to see the original Halloween. And that was a huge deal for me. And I watched that movie over and over and over again. I was obsessed with it. And then I think the third sort of the when I went and saw Cameron's Aliens in the theater, and I saw it opening night, and it was like that was a life-changing movie-going experience for me, where I decided I was going to figure out a way to do that, because the audience went nuts and I went nuts, and I've never seen people jump out of their seats in the theater and cheer like that. And so that had a huge impact on me.
Those are three great titles, and yeah. It sounds like you probably also really freaked out your parents if they didn't know you were in the room and you ran out screaming.
Yeah, but then like my parents got a divorce, and then okay. This is going somewhere. And then my dad had figured out that I loved horror movies, because we would go to the video store and I would like stray away from the children's section, and I would look at the boxes of all the horror movies, and I was so into it. And he finally was like, fuck it. Just rent them. And so at age 7, yeah, I started every single weekend until I was 18 years old, I think. I would rent 5 or 6 horror movies every weekend and watch everything. Everything.
It's a good diet.
Hey, it paid off.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Okay.
So
that wasn't part of your question. I just went there.
No, that's really interesting.
Brennan, this is your show now.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah,
let's go.
Okay, Brennan's show.
Welcome back to Shockwaves. I'm Brennan. try out ZipRecruiter/Brennan. Yeah, basically, I guess we can move on into our topic.
Yeah, yeah.
A topic that we have been wanting to get into, but we needed a good conduit.
Yeah, and Brennan
I've
had
heard
been
about this topic.
Yeah, because Brennan had been asking me for a couple of months, like back in the last summer and things, you know, he kept saying you guys should do this topic. And I was like, well, if we do, you're coming on for it.
Yes. Persistence works out.
Yeah. So it works. So we are doing queer horror today.
Yeah. Like generally the LGBT spectrum. The Hollywood doesn't like to make these movies. But especially,
but they like them when they come out. That's when I always see like rave reviews. Oh, and there's a gay character in there, but yeah, they're hard to get made.
Yeah. And the thing is, Hollywood also really prioritizes the G out of that spectrum, because that also a lot of gay people are white males. And to be frank, I am one of those too. But the thing is, Hollywood is kind of okay with a story about a white dude, even if he's gay. So the L and the B and the T don't really get a lot of attention. So a lot of what we're going to be talking about today probably is gay oriented, especially because those are the ones that I've seen, probably the ones that Chris has seen. I don't want to assume anything about the movies that you've seen.
Don't assume anything.
Okay. No, but the thing about LGBT horror is that it is very much, it's like any regional horror. Like if you really like, I don't know, Becca, you probably like Yugoslavian horror or something.
Yes, I can name a couple.
Yeah, this episode's not about that, so we don't have to.
Probably.
But the thing is, the gay community is very much like that kind of thing. It's a minority that doesn't get a lot of money to make their films, but they're still being made, especially in the past 10, 20 years. Since the 80s, it's kind of picked up a little bit. But the thing is, that also means that sometimes there's a bit of a quality gap. So you have to kind of get past some very low budget, kind of not super professional looks to it in order to get to some content. But you guys as horror fans are pretty familiar with that.
How are you defining this though? Are you defining it like by the creator of the film, the subjects,
I'm defining it in terms of like technical quality, in terms of, some of these films are made by people who are not professionals. But who kind of can tap into something. And that's some of my favorite films are the ones that someone who is totally divorced from the rules of what Hollywood is forcing people to make and can just totally crack open their brain and pour it onto a film. And that's what a lot of these movies are like, but not all of them are great. So I just want to warn you guys.
Did you ever have a moment identifying with a character in a horror film that might surprise people on that level? Like,
that's a great question.
Sorry.
no, honestly, I actually have a lot of trouble identifying with characters in movies because I don't generally find people that I can relate to. And it's not just because of sexuality. Yeah. I just feel like I don't see myself represented on screen a lot. And representation is like, Susan, we're all desperately seeking it. I wrote that like 2 weeks ago.
It played well.
But honestly, the first character that I recognized any portion of myself in wasn't in a horror film. It was in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. It's Kieran Culkin as Scott Pilgrim's gay roommate. And I think that's the first gay character I saw in a mainstream film. I hadn't seen Brokeback Mountain. I was in eighth grade when it came out. I was not ready for an Ang Lee 2.5 hour drama. But what I want to know is the same question for Chris. What's the first like character in a horror movie that you really related to, male or female, whatever?
In a horror movie? Oh, man. I can't say that I ever have.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, I really... I've seen gay characters in movies and thought I could maybe be that person at some point in my life.
Mm-hmm, but that's not
like
me.
Like Rope.
Yes. Yeah, people always forget Rope. Yeah. That's a very
Rope was definitely.
But was there anything that came close? Traits, characteristics, anything at all?
No, or not that I related to.
Right.
Were there, and I think that was part of it for me though too. Like yeah. You have to understand my fixation and my obsession with horror was 100% connected to my fear of my sexuality.
Right.
Like it was this like total place for me to escape to. And my daily life, especially, I mean, being bullied in school, you know, like I had the double whammy of I was an effete, non-sporty gay kid with a celebrity parent. And so, like, I got called, like, Little House on the Ferry and things like that, which were not very flattering or fun, right?
I had no idea that was your dad.
I had no idea that was your dad either.
And I grew up with that show and loved it, so there you go.
So I had...
Wait, were you out as a young person, or were people assuming you were
gay? No, they just assumed yeah, I mean, I had, like, nice feathered hair and, like, cute outfits and the whole deal.
At what age did you come out?
I was 21. When I came out.
That's pretty young. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Not too bad, especially for way back then.
Brennan, how old were you?
I was a sophomore in high school when I came out.
Oh, so you were pretty early.
Yeah, that's early.
Yeah.
That's
I mean, we're living in the future, I guess. So it's starting to happen a little earlier. Mm-hmm. People are becoming more comfortable. There was a GSA in my school.
Yeah, see, we didn't
I was
have
in the
that.
Theater program.
Well, and there's also media representations now, like TV shows. And I mean, it must make a big difference. Not all the difference in the world, but a big difference, I'd say.
Getting closer.
Yeah, I mean, visibility isn't necessarily acceptance, but it's definitely like, oh, I'm aware of the possibility of a man loving another man.
Yeah.
Right.
Which isn't something that was represented or talked about. So a lot of people coming out in the years and decades before were really struggling with feelings that they couldn't even put words to.
Right.
Because that's not something that was represented. So yeah, that definitely helped me a lot. Mm. Even though I personally very rarely feel represented in movies, there's at least a visibility to a community, even if it's just Jack. Like, it's still something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to play act as those kinds of characters, but I don't know. That's not me, but whatever.
Mm. So Nightmare on Elm Street 2. the buried lead. No, I am actually genuinely curious, like, when you guys, because when I started, it's just a scary movie when I was young. It wasn't until I watched the big documentary
nuances.
Where the subtext, Jack Shoulders obviously a straight, probably 50-year-old guy when he was making that movie. When you watched it for the first time, did you see anything that seemed... made that film stand out like it was about something else in terms of subtext?
Not the first time that I saw it. I saw it when it was in theaters, I think. So it was a long time ago. And I just thought it was a scary movie.
It is, but, it's kind of a disturbing one of them.
And I had already been exposed to the idea that it was homoerotic before I saw
and
it.
And you couldn't see it any other way, I assume, right?
Oh, how could you not?
Once
a rectum drawn on the board.
Oh, those shower scenes early on in the
it's
brutal.
They definitely had
hitting the nail.
They definitely had that vibe. But there also was like this, I remember when I was in high school, I can't remember the name of the director, but it was this like, this dude who made these like beyond homoerotic vampire movies.
Is that David Dakota?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with David Dakota.
It has to be,
I'm dropping a David Dakota there.
David, somebody.
Is that The Brotherhood?
There was a ton of
or the 1313 series.
Because I remember I would like
shout out to David, who's probably listening.
House of Usher series.
Yeah, so there was like, but those were like the most overtly gay horror films that I had seen.
Yeah. There's also like must be a big difference between the word gay and the word camp. And I think one of the problems with cinema is it goes camp, and then I think a lot of people can't identify with camp. No. Like camp's a different thing than sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think of like the reason why things like Brokeback and Moonlight are so effective is it gets to somebody who's never even maybe doesn't even know a gay person and suddenly is in the emotional train of these people.
Camp, you know? Unfortunately, for, I mean like a campy gay film, camp was sort of like the sort of the sad vehicle that I think gay people use to pander to straights,
like absolutely,
please like me, I'm funny.
It's the John Waters technique.
Yeah, it was like dance for grandma, and like you know, it wasn't real, and it wasn't anything that we could recognize or identify with.
And there's a certain thing about coming out where you've bottled up these feelings and these emotions and just your identity for so long that when you come out, it's kind of like a rubber band snapping. You want to be everything all at once. Hmm. And I feel like camp kind of speaks to that. Like it's so over the top and it's so big and it's so uninhibited. It's kind of like, I want to be that. I want to be so unafraid and just like do anything that
comes to mind. Like partially a statement to be clear on who you are.
Yeah.
In a way that's otherwise hard to tell, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why, like, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is kind of like a seminal, like, gay classic, even though there's nothing LGBT about the plotline at all.
Mommy Dearest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
God, I watched that movie a million times, partly because I actually did identify a little with that movie.
Yeah. Wait a minute. I'm 2 for 2 and love both of these. What's happening? Something happening.
You can love movies.
Wait. Do you love Showgirls?
I love Showgirls.
I've actually been meaning to rewatch Showgirls because I've never given a second chance.
It's fucking brilliant.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. In theaters, I was like, I don't know what the hell's going on.
You have to look at it in the same terms that you would of Starship Troopers, where it's very tongue-in-cheek, it's very over the top, it's satire, and I don't think that it was received that way.
I will say, I remember liking Kyle MacLachlan a lot in it. I remember going, ooh, he's all kind of edgy in this.
Like,
uh-oh, what just happened?
I have a question for Chris.
Yes.
Is there a celebrity crush that you had that you, looking back, you now realize was a crush, where you're like, oh, I love watching this guy's movies?
I didn't have a celebrity crush per se, but I had there were moments when I look back, I was like, oh, of course, that's why I was so into that scene. Top Gun.
The
volleyball scene in Top Gun, I remember I went and saw that with my sisters, and I was very into that movie.
Like, is there a volleyball team?
Was it Iceman? Was it Iceman or not?
It was the combo. Goose.
It was the combo.
And the song.
Punch.
That's so funny because I saw a musical it was a two shows as musicals, 45 minutes long each, and it was Showgirls and Top Gun.
Whoa.
I think Rob's actors coming around to musicals. Yeah. I'm hearing it.
Occasionally. Occasionally.
But there were like other movies. I mean, I can go all the way back to being a kid and when I saw like Flash Gordon. And I had the hots for Flash Gordon. And it was like, you know, I drew after I saw Flash Gordon too, like it was right around Easter and I wrote a letter to the Easter Bunny. And for some reason I drew all of these Flash Gordon like men around the Easter Bunny flexing. and it was like, you know, dear Easter Bunny, please bring me a basket. And now when I look back at it, I'm like,
you gave the Easter Bunny something to look at.
But the funny thing is, in Flash Gordon, he is playing with a golden egg. Yeah. Like that's what they're tossing around as a football.
And I was looking for a basket. So.
Oh god.
Full circle, but up bump.
Yeah, my mom's gay story of like, oh, we knew, was at a choreographed dance to Lucky by Britney Spears.
Oh wow.
When I was a child. But
do you still know it? Do you still have the moves?
No, it's gone. It's gone forever.
You need to bring that back, Brad.
Yeah. I'll work on it. I'll see if there's videos. It. But my celebrity crush, where later I was like, oh shoot, that's exactly what that was Sean Ashmore. He was Iceman in X-Men, which is probably where most people know him.
Yeah.
But he played, he was a lead in the Animorphs TV series, which I loved.
Oh, he's cute.
He's a Bowsman.
Yeah. 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 He was,
he's been in a couple
Mother's
of Bowsman
Day
films.
He was in Frozen. Yeah. He was in The Ruins, which is based on my favorite
book. I like The Ruins. It's a good movie.
I like the disdain. He was in The Ruins.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Ruins is great.
You give Ruins some love.
I like
I was over pronunciating.
I like The Ruins.
That's like shade. The Ruins is a solid body horror movie. It's not as good as the book, but nothing is.
Right.
But The Ruins is like my favorite book. Okay. So, like,
I'm going to ask a weird question because I think we've all struggled struggled with. Like, how did, is it any different? Identification with Final Girls. I've always thought it's so hard for anyone to really get down to the nitty gritty of why that worked so well. And thinking about it as like young heterosexual boys watching it, it was always confusing to go, oh, you're identifying with them, but you want to watch them,
right.
But you also kind of want to be them, but you want them because that's where your sexuality is building. Was it any different, like from your perspective growing up seeing, because that was, as big slasher fans, both of you, I'm just curious.
Slashers are, I mean, obviously everyone can and should relate to the final girl,
yeah.
Because first of all, she's the main character, usually the only one with character traits of any kind.
That's true. Yeah.
But she's the survivor. Like,
yeah.
She's the one who like, you know, has to like outsmart the killer and is, yeah. You know, is tenacious and knows how to fight back and all that. And I think that if there's anything to relate to as a gay kid, it was sort of like, that was kind of like going to school.
You have to be tenacious.
You were the final girl every day at school.
Oh, that's really sad.
Jesus.
that bumps me out.
Yeah.
For me, going to high school, like 2009 and 2012 is when I went to high school. For me, it was much different. Also, I went to high school in Southern California, even though it was in Orange County, which is not the best part of Southern California if you're gay. Like, things are a lot different now, not so much in the middle of the country, some places.
Yeah.
But bullying is much more of a crime that people are willing to give visibility to, or at least people are talking about more. There's more of a discussion about it and how it is definitely a bad thing.
Yeah.
Just in the same way that stalking has become a crime since the 80s. Like, people are actually paying attention to
it. Is it a crime?
I mean, or at least like, well,
it is
Facebook stalking,
that,
different story.
Well, but social media, I mean, we've seen it just in the last few days with the Weinstein stuff. Social media, it gives voice to things that a lot of the things are coming from the past. They're coming from 20 years ago, and it's not it doesn't devalue them. It means that only now do people feel like anyone's listening and can share each other's experiences, and that power comes from that experience.
And I do have to say that I think stalking has definitely become something that's more high profile now.
Absolutely.
Because like, even when I went to high school in the late 90s, if a dude was like following you around, sending you letters, calling your phone all the time, he was just annoying. And there was really nothing you could do about it, even if you kind of felt like threatened by him. If he wasn't doing anything, then there was nothing you could do. He's just an asshole. But now we actually have a term for that, and it's considered to be a threat, even if he's not actually doing physical harm.
And Kevin Williamson even wrote a show about it.
Yeah, yes. And I think I was helped out because my bullies were kind of idiots.
Yeah.
Most are. Yeah. No, but literally, it was just, I got catcalled a couple times. It's not a big deal. Like, you have to learn to deal with that kind of thing when you're coming out, and it's just a fact of life that happens.
How many of your bullies have now co-hosted Shockwaves?
Exactly.
That's two snaps in a circle.
There is one time I was walking down the street with my boyfriend in high school, and some dude yelled at us across the street like, oh, you're gay, huh? You want to have sex with me? Like, as if like, oh, that's what you like to do.
So they're both insulting and soliciting you.
Yeah, basically.
Very smooth. So
that's like what I had to deal with. And it's just,
that's
like,
called hedging your bets, man.
Yeah. Had to beat him away with a stick.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, things have definitely changed, but it's still an immensely difficult process to go through. And I lost the track of what the question was. But
I think you actually bring up how horror was a place of escape and safety, but you're also identifying with somebody who has to survive every day. And I think that's quite a powerful analogy.
Yeah.
And a visual in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Now,
sorry.
Oh, go ahead. No.
I just wanted to say, speaking of, we are recording on National Coming Out Day. That is today.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. I thought, wasn't it Mental Health Day, or was that yesterday?
There's a lot of days.
They're all happening today.
Now.
I guess the two could be interrelated in lots of ways, I bet.
So, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Like, when you were watching things like that, I'll say, have subverted gay tones, like Fright Night. Like, did the tones speak more to you than they would have, like, when I watched it and thought nothing of it until later somebody wrote an article? I actually think it was you.
That one wasn't me.
That wasn't you. Okay. And then somebody wrote an article for us at Blumhouse about the gay tones in Fright Night. And then I suddenly went, oh my God, you're
Becca.
Right. Like, I'd never caught it before.
Look, so, and that's not to cast aspersions on Fright Night. Fright Night's still a great movie.
No, I'm talking about calling attention to it. I mean, I saw it opening night, and I was clear. It was apparent even in my youth. I was like, oh, these guys got something going. It's awesome.
Never picked up on it. They just live together. They're like roommates. It's all good.
Or how about The Lost Boys?
Like, see, that one, I would. You wrote an article on that for us, and that one I would have never.
I actually didn't write that article either.
Somebody else did.
But isn't that vampirism in general? Because I always feel vampirism. Like the erotic is can go anyway. Yeah.
That's
sexuality is more fluid in vampire tales.
I mean, if we look back at the 70s or 60s mm-hmm. and 70s, like a lot of like the Euro trash films were really kind of pushing that vampires as lesbians thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, vampires, lesbos, daughters of darkness.
That's even the classy side of it, like The Hunger.
The Hunger, yes, absolutely. Totally classy. Did these resonate with you, or were they more like exploitive?
Like the homoerotic undertones of like those 80s movies and things like that? I don't know. Do you have an answer to that, Chris?
I don't think that they resonated with me per se. I mean, I think if they were operating for me, it was on some very subconscious level. Mm-hmm. But again, you're also dealing with at least for me, I was so deep in the business of my own repression that it made it even difficult for me to recognize things like that.
Mm-hmm. You want to push it away.
Yeah. So like it was just in a corner, you know, in the dark.
Wow.
And because it is subtext, so it is hidden and you can't ignore it if you choose to. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
I
think it's funny because I'm hearing what everybody's saying, and I'm thinking like even when Elric was talking about the final girl and how you know you maybe subliminally you know kind of desire the final girl or want you know whatever the case is. I don't think I picked up honestly on any of these themes until I was more of an adult. I just loved horror movies and like it didn't like the final girl wasn't a girl to me. She's like, oh, that's the kick-ass character that's going to be the main person. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, Evil Ed didn't seem like a gay character. It's like that seems like kind of like me and my nerdy friends who like horror a little too much. So I don't know. I wonder if maybe you have to hit a level of maturity in terms of understanding yourself before you can spot these things.
I think it's definitely the layers. You just kind of peel away as you get older. You start uncovering those things.
You learn about society and sexuality as you age.
The one movie I saw at a semi young age, I think I was probably just starting high school, that really kind of that I saw, like it was probably my first scenic portrayal of homosexuality, was Liquid Sky.
Oh, yeah.
Has anybody else seen this one recently?
Vinegar Syndrome's putting it out again.
Yeah, since you guys haven't seen it, it's literally about two girls living together, and then one of the girls plays two roles. She plays both the female living with the other female in the gay relationship, but then she also plays a man, a very androgynous man in it, who's supposed to be like her rival model. And what still is impressive about it is it was made in the early 80s, but they don't draw attention to it, which feels like any other film during this time period that would have been kind of an exploitive moment where they draw attention to it. In this one, you're just submerged into it and it just exists. And then the movie proceeds onward from there. And it's a really arty film, so it's not like a lot of people saw it, but it's one that I still kind of remember as being like that. It struck me as odd at the time, but then you just go with it and you're there.
Yeah, it's funny how you see things, because I remember Cruising got a ton of flack. Like, people really hammer that film, especially back then.
Yeah.
But it's funny, as a young person, when I saw it, it actually, and being, growing up, and like, I'm pretty sure I knew as a, you know, straight kid at, say, 14, 15, whenever I saw that movie, I felt deep empathy for gay people watching that movie. Like I was scared for the situation of that movie. And so to me, that's a success. Like, that doesn't feel exploitive. You know, as a kid, I didn't think it was exploitive. Mm-hmm. Maybe the way he made it was, I don't know. I know he got a lot of flack apparently he was in full leather while the cast were wearing leather in the bars while they directed, which is kind of amazing. How do movies like that, especially obviously because what they're also talking about, I mean, that's a little ahead of the AIDS curve of AIDS at the time, but it felt now when you watch it, it's haunting to think of that connection and that film.
No, Cruising is really interesting. I think we could talk about this forever.
I think it's a fascinating movie.
You've seen it, right?
Yeah, I've seen it. Okay. I think it's interesting because I mean that is, I thought it was very daring and that it got made and that it got made crazy. Through a studio system, no less, and
like with Pacino as a lead.
Yeah. Like this would never happen now
because the implications in it are pretty. Like it doesn't all the way go there on the surface with Pacino's character, but it really has implications.
It was not afraid of showing.
Yeah.
The world.
Did you see it after you came out?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
No, but the thing about Cruising for me is whether or not it was exploiting that subculture. Yeah. First of all, it's a document of a subculture that vanished almost immediately after that. And also, for me at least, I thought the like the gay sex scenes without Al Pacino, because there is that element of gay panic.
Yeah.
Like the sex scenes that were between two gay men were very erotic and very like actually human in a way. Obviously they were in more intense than a normal like vanilla session of sex, but I felt like that was relatable and presented in a way that was human.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally wasn't offended by it. Obviously, I don't speak for the entire gay community, especially in 1980, but I thought that was a really interesting and like human way of approaching those characters for like 45-50% of it.
Yeah, and scary. Like it's a scary because the killer keeps changing, which is just such an unusual thing. That's why it's like I think it's a really interesting horror film, not just a thriller or whatever, because the thing is kind of almost a supernatural thing, but probably I'd assume commenting on early ideas of what AIDS was before it was called AIDS, right? Whatever was happening in the community, you know?
The sexual repression is such an important part of any slasher film. Mm. Because, you know, the machete or whatever is generally a phallic symbol and it's penetrating women and it's these sexually frustrated killers. But instead it subverted that and it's about a sexually frustrated gay man. And obviously, if that's the only representation of a gay man in film, that is a problem.
Yeah.
But the fact that, like, it takes that subtext and kind of makes it text about something that is a huge problem in the gay community. And what I loved is in Cruising, the killer stabs everyone in the back, which is very strong symbolism, I must say.
Yeah.
But it's a creepy movie and it's actually about sexual repression pretty directly. And that's really interesting.
Yeah. Even explain the black cowboy.
What?
The guy who comes in, just he comes out
of the guy in the police station?
He's like 7 foot tall, and it's the weirdest scene I've ever seen.
That's just how the police work. Have you never
I'm glad I had you on the show for today.
Yeah. Frankly, I think Cruising very much falls apart in the third act.
Yeah.
It's too ambiguous and very boring because Al Pacino is empty in that role. And there's a lot that you can put onto him.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I'm implying a lot that I thought it was darker and more interesting about sexuality. Like maybe this guy has had wanted to try out something for himself, not just because he's undercover, and then felt so guilty and repressed and angry that maybe he becomes the darkness. You know? Which, and I don't know if that's the factual reading, but I remember when I first started, I was like, oh my God, is that saying what I think it's saying about this character? Which is interesting.
Is Cruising on Blu-ray?
Yeah, I think it is now. I started DCP.
Time, I have actually never seen
this
movie.
Dude.
Oh, no,
it's really
definitely check it out. Yeah.
I started on a DCP recently, so it must be. Yeah, with Sorcerer and really on DCP, you could see things you could never see before because the VHS was so dark.
Yeah.
I remember being able to, you know, it just felt so kind of insidious in a way.
But,
anyway, yeah, Cruising is just one that's always on my mind in that way because it just seems like it's bold.
Yeah.
And you don't often the problem is you get like a character who's just like a black character. It's the token character who's hitting all the boxes that they think's fun and, you know, works with society and it's Glee or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that to me doesn't necessarily seem like it would be to me. It wouldn't be that satisfying a role model or representation of something, you know, that's a lot broader, you know, caricature.
And that's the problem. The reason a lot of gay men especially tend to relate to female characters is that there's so little representation of gay characters, and especially, you know, lesbian, bisexual, and trans characters, but I can't really speak from those perspectives. You kind of judge them really harshly. You're like, oh, that doesn't represent me, and it's the only thing out there, so I don't like this. And that's generally a problem. Now it's slightly less, but not like – there's some stories around, but
– there was like a celebration of American Horror Story a couple of years ago. And this was like just that in the majority of the seasons of American Horror Stories, they have in some capacity included a queer character.
That was first season. Yeah. Season one was Zach Quinto.
Yeah. And then second season, they had, Anna Banana was the hotel did too.
Murphy's always been
definitely always
he always embraces and pushes it he pushes those boundaries and
he's
pushes
definitely
the
been one of those people that's out there like and he has the power and the voice and the ability to do it, which is what's even greater about him, because I think there are a lot of other filmmakers and producers and people out there who don't use their voice to try and sort of, you know, incorporate more gay characters and into their work. So
yeah, and
tough.
I was gonna say, I just feel like an American Horror Story is doing a lot where big screen horror is lacking. You know, there's just a lot of representation, a lot of really cool stuff happening.
And that's what, that's what the current TV system is kind of allowing people to do, too. But let us also not overlook that he's also a huge advocate for people with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. Like, he represents a lot of communities on his show.
Yeah.
And that is really interesting, even though some of the seasons are shakier than others.
Right.
Yeah.
What's your favorite season of American Horror Story, Chris? Do you watch it?
I've only seen a couple
okay
seasons. This is probably blasphemy. I'm not a huge fan of that particular series.
That's
fine.
Ryan
Murphy, I think you're a genius. I've never really connected with, I did like the first season, which I saw. I tried to get into, was it Coven?
That was the witch one.
Yes. Yeah. The third season. Yeah. Those are the only two I've seen.
And again, I think for me that it's going to sound, rich coming from me, but like it was, a lot of it was too campy for me. It kept me at an emotional distance. But I think there's some really cool stuff going on in the show, mm-hmm. but I'm the wrong guy.
That's okay. We can move on.
Yeah. Well, I want to know, Brennan, you talked about some of these more underground films that are actually being made by the gay community for the gay community.
Yes.
And I wanted to hear some recommendations because I've not seen most of these.
Well, I can give you one title that I know is specifically was made for the gay audience with gay characters that I remember kind of being blown away by just because nothing seemed different about it. It just seemed like a traditional slasher. And that was from 2004 and it's called Hellbent.
Yes, actually I have a copy of it in my bag.
I have seen that one too.
Yeah, which was produced by, is it Irwin LeBlanc who did Halloween? Or it was somebody that was involved with the original Halloween produced it.
And the director was Paul Etheridge. Paul Etheridge.
Who's a really cool guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, I have not seen that. And it
effectively used a glass eye in a way that no one
deserves. I think it was Joseph Wolfe who produced the early Halloween. Yes, that's the producer. Yeah. Wrong one. But
yeah, Hellbent is a very effective mid-2000s slasher, and it's the exact quality you would expect from a mid-2000s slasher, but it has those really interesting elements, especially the glass eye.
Glass eye was a winner.
It was an interesting time that it came out, too. It didn't get enough attention. I felt like, because it was at a time when it was, what, it was 2004? So you had the Dawn of the Dead remake. You had the rise of horror.
It was a big deal in the gay community. I saw that movie at the, it was the opening night premiere of Outfest.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's where I saw it. And I was so thrilled that it was a horror movie.
Yeah.
And that it was a gay horror movie because I personally didn't, I don't know that many.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And have over the years, I mean, I've tried to get a couple gay horror things off the ground and it's hard.
It was tough. There's not a lot of money in that.
We gotta talk.
No, I mean, I'm serious. Even with some heavy hitters, like I remember, this was years ago, Clive Barker, Bill Condon, and I were trying to do. We were trying to make the Books of Blood, and we were going to make an anthology film.
Yeah.
And nobody would touch it. Like they just did not want to finance that movie. And it was a real bummer for all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we loved it, and we thought this would be so cool to do like a really awesome, you know, gay anthology horror film. But nope.
Okay, I have a question jumping off of that. Because it is so hard to get a gay movie off the ground, your movies are primarily for a heterosexual audience with heterosexual characters. Do you feel the same disconnect making a movie like that as you do watching a movie like that? Because, first of all, your movies are great. I love them all. But I want to know how you feel about
that creation process. I don't feel a disconnect at all because and I think this is a part of being, I think, at a very comfortable place in my sexuality. My identification with other people and other characters isn't directly correlated to my sexual orientation. And so I identify with people on just a very emotional level. And so, for example, in Happy Death Day, I can identify with Tree because I think that I understand that arc. I understand what it's like to be hurt and to carry that hurt around for so long that it sours you as a person. And then to have the opportunity to become someone else, or at least to sort of, or to become the old you, really, which is what the movie's about.
that's just can't wait to see it.
That's just a human thing. And so,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and I don't feel I don't feel a disconnect because I don't have lead gay characters. I would like to. I would like to, but I also like have to face the reality of a system. And part of me wants to fight against the system. Look, the funny thing is I got my big break and my big break, I put in air quotes, the Larry Clark movie that we talked about earlier. The script that got me that break was a horror, was a gay horror film. That was the first thing that I wrote. And it was about a guy struggling with his sexuality who meets another guy who's really cute, who invites him over to his house. And then he ends up being trapped in the house with a guy who's much more fucked up and dealing with his shit than our lead character is. And it was nice that at least Larry could recognize that right away and saw something in the writing. But that was a movie I would have loved to have made. But it was just, it's so hard in the system, unless you are an 800-pound gorilla, unless you really have some serious clout, it's definitely a trickier thing to do because everybody absolutely. Automatically cuts out a whole market. They're like, none of the straights are coming.
So how do they justify in the situation now, how does somebody who turns down, a gay themed film justify that? Oh, well, we won't have the audience when a movie like Moonlight does breakthrough, movies like Brokeback Mountain, and what are they doing differently that are causing, and I use me as a model because like I was saying, sometimes if I see camp, I'm instantly like detached. But I remember Brokeback was one of the most moved I've ever been in my life. And Moonlight, like literally like, you know, the last act of that with the two men circling each other. And I was very conscious of it going, oh, you know, what's really interesting is this is something I've never experienced myself. And yet I'm totally in their situation. So I'm trying in my brain afterwards to process like, how is it working so well where other things haven't?
Right.
And I've heard Bret Easton Ellis kind of went off on the opposite, saying it's not gay enough, and like they're hiding the gay sex and they're scared of it. And I was like, oh, and I could, and maybe he's right. Maybe that would turn off an audience. I don't know. Yeah, so I was trying
I could lean into that argument for Brokeback. I would not lean into that for Moonlight, but
because the desire is so clear in Moonlight. They show desire, and I think that's more important than sex.
And I agree. I think that, I mean, look, there's different scenarios. I think if you have, you know, you have a filmmaker like Ang Lee and two very big stars, that's one kind of a situation. And then Moonlight is even hard for me to fathom
how that
got made. I'm so grateful that it did. I think
it's an audience too. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like the audience that's going to see Moonlight, once they see horror or genre, they go, oh
yeah,
you know, right. Turn their nose up at it.
Yeah.
No, regardless of the subject matter.
Right. Doesn't matter. Yeah.
But by the way, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like
absolutely.
It's only a matter of time.
No,
it's
totally.
it's going to take the right filmmaker and it's going to take the right script, but like there will be a very commercially successful horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in the near future. It's just that it takes people with balls to do it, you know, and people who aren't afraid to step into that. I hope they do.
Yeah.
And that's why we're talking to Chris tomorrow morning. Chris, we're going to call you.
I mean, yeah, the horror community and the gay community are both communities that are on the fringes of society or of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So there is a reason they both meet so frequently, but also a reason they don't hit the mainstream quite as much.
Yeah.
But I do have some recommendations.
Yeah, let's hit us with a couple.
Okay. There were five things that I was looking at that I really wanted to talk about. The first one is actually a movie from 2015. It's called You're Killing Me. It's from a director named Jim Henson, not Jim Henson, but it's basically, I don't think anybody ever watched TBS's Search Party, which they should.
It's very much a
parody of the self-involved like millennial hipster culture. And You're Killing Me is basically that, except these self-involved millennial hipsters are totally missing the point that one of their number is a serial killer. So basically the lead, his name is Jeffrey Self, and he's a pretty prominent like gay celebrity in the, you know, in the community. And he starts dating this guy who's really cute and really funny, but he doesn't realize that all of his jokes about killing people are actually just him telling facts. And he's so invested in his phone and his YouTube career that he doesn't actually notice that he's murdering all of his friends. It's not quite able to reach feature length. Because it is very much a sketch idea, but for like 85-90% of it, it's truly hilarious. Like, it's a really funny movie. It also stars Brian Safi, who has an LGBT/women's issues podcast called Throwing Shade, which is really good. Yeah, that movie is just incredibly funny. I had a great time watching it.
It's got Mindy Cohn.
Oh yeah.
That is amazing. And Drew, who's awesome.
Yeah.
He was the gay. I had a gay zombie in Scouts.
Huh. Oh yeah.
There's so much. By the way, there's so much gay in Scouts Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Oh yeah.
I have a gay zombie performing a Britney Spears song. I have a whole fight/chase sequence to Dolly Parton's 9 to 5.
Oh, I loved that movie. I actually watched it like a week and a half ago to prepare for this thing. There's literally a scene where a guy's hanging out of a window attached to like an old man's dong, which is hilarious.
It's amazing.
Like, cause you know, it's for teenagers, but it's also for everyone. It's hilarious. It's great.
That's Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, which is currently on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
As dong is Cruising. Everybody check it out.
Cruising is also on Prime. We just saw that.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So you can do a double feature of those two. Let us know.
Oh my.
That's the best double feature.
But there's another one I wanted to bring up. It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. And I think every episode, you guys, one of the charms you have is that you kind of pull out a title that like, it's like, everyone go check this one out. And it's kind of like a conversation piece. And I really hope this is that one. It might only be for me.
Okay.
So I might be totally wrong, but it's called Ghost Writer. Mm-hmm. Not Ghost Writer, not the Ghost Writer with Angelina Jolie. It is also called Suffering Man's Charity. It is from 2007, and it's Alan Cumming's directorial debut. Oh. It stars himself.
It's David Boreanaz.
Yeah,
Kane's in.
David Boreanaz and Alan Cumming. Alan Cumming is this guy who's kind of like, David Boreanaz is a struggling writer who's like writing the next great American novel. And
I remember
straight.
This cover, yeah.
Yeah.
This cast is crazy. Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher, Henry Thomas from
Karen
E.T.
Black.
And Jane Lynch is in it,
and
too.
And Jane Lynch.
So basically, David Boreanaz is boarding with Alan Cumming, who's this really fancy pants, like high culture guy. And basically, the first act is just Alan Cumming and Henry Thomas. And it's like a one act play of them talking about culture and their lives. And it's surprisingly interesting. Mm. But then the second act turns into like a Saw movie almost. Not gory. But basically, it's Alan Cumming ties up David Boreanaz, and he's basically quizzing him on literature and punishing him if he gets things wrong, because he's like, you're a writer and you don't even know all of this stuff. And the thing is, Alan, when directors direct themselves as actors, they can kind of allow themselves to be totally unhinged because there's no one checking them.
Nothing stopping them.
Yeah. And Alan Cumming's performance is... If you don't like Camp, maybe this isn't the movie for you.
I do like Alan Cumming, though. I always like
him. Yeah. His performance is one of the craziest, most demented things I've ever seen. There's a line that I always remember. And Mom, if you're listening, I'm sorry. There's a cuss word in this line. But basically, he's just like talking to David Boreanaz, who can't spell. And he's like, it's Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, as in, you're a fucking idiot. And it's just like that the whole time. It's the most bananas movie I've ever seen.
Okay.
The third act is crazy.
Suffering Man's Charity is a terrible title.
Yeah, that's,
like, that's just
not
unpronounceable. You don't even want to think about that.
But I remember this cover, and it did not at all sound like what you just described.
No, it's like... It
looks like Fear.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's like Misery and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane had a child, and that child wrote an off-Broadway play.
Wow.
It's fascinating.
I want that on the box cover.
Yeah.
It's so good. Again, might only be for me, but I hope people check it out, and I hope they like it, because it's really weird.
Okay.
And that's what I always try to look for in horror movies, is things I've never could have even imagined or seen before. And there's a lot of that in this movie.
Okay. I like the cast. I'm in.
Okay, great. Should I just keep going?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay.
I'm getting some good titles here.
There's a 1996 German movie, Trauma was involved, I think, called Killer Condom.
Oh, yeah.
We did an article about this, about
Chris,
it being one of like the most cutting edge movies in sexuality in general.
Yes.
And H.R. Giger did the design.
Wait, I don't really? I don't
Giger,
know.
Giger had
Giger
something.
Designed the condom.
Giger had something to do with
I'm
the
Googling
condom.
I'm Googling this. Hold on.
Okay. That's amazing.
It was directed by Martin Waltz, and it is in German, but it's set in New York with American characters. It's about basically this killer condom attack, like biting dudes' dicks off in this brothel.
Okay, Giger designed the condom creature.
Oh, that's so crazy. Cool. I did not know that.
Yep.
It's like, it's simultaneously this silly, campy B movie, but also like a really harrowing metaphor for the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
Because it's basically about how the people in the
Chris just pulled up a screen.
Totally Giger.
Yeah, the people in charge of society, like the police and the politicians, they totally ignore this condom that's biting people's dicks off because it's affecting prostitutes and it's affecting gay people. And so they're like, we don't really care about those people and what they're up to. So they ignore the problem until it becomes totally insurmountable. Hmm. And killer condoms biting dicks off left and right.
Is it actually fun? It looks kind of fun.
It's genuinely incredible. There's a really sweet gay love story between like an old grizzled hard-boiled cop and like a young callboy that's like actually really romantic.
Interesting.
Trauma's always been good about that.
Yes, yeah. They have.
They've always been about representing. Yeah.
And there's a wonderful article, you can Google it, by one of my favorite writers, Whitney Seibold, called Why Killer Condom is Actually a Really Important Movie, comma, No Seriously.
Yeah.
And it's a great article, but it goes through how it really did kind of play into like the sexual, the idea of the 80s, that there was sexual freedom, but there was still hysteria about the diseases that were being spread and about how even though that this movie is silly, that it really does have all of these deep messages to it. So I don't think I've ever actually watched Killer Condom.
No, it's funny as hell, too. But it's, like, really effective, and it's so silly with the condom running around with its little teeth. But I really enjoyed it.
Hold on. So it was designed – this is getting crazier.
Okay.
Layers. It was designed by Giger, but the actual monster was made by – I'm going to say his name wrong – Buttergeist, who made Necromantic. He made the actual monster.
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
There is another immortal line here. It's, what can a man do in New York if he's lonely and without a dick?
Okay. Hit us with one more.
Yeah. This one's actually a TV show. It's a BBC series called In the Flesh.
It's phenomenal.
It's phenomenal.
I love this show.
It's a gay zombie series. Mm-hmm. It's basically about they've kind of invented a cure for zombieism. Like they can kind of give them their minds and their old personalities back if they take a pill like every day or something like that. Huh. And it's about this teen boy who's trying to reintegrate into his small town after being a zombie. But he's also gay. And it kind of combines those two stigmas of people who are like, you ate my uncle. I don't want you in my town. Uh-huh. And also you're gay and we don't approve of this. Right.
And it also feels like I always saw it, and I've only watched like part of the first season, mm-hmm. but for me, it felt like a metaphor for depression as well.
It's everything.
Or mental issues where like they're taking this pill, but it's denying them themselves. And so it's kind of that metaphor of like taking medicine to cover up mental problems where it feels like you're a different person on it. Mm. Like you're not being true. And like there's a lot of allegories going on in the show.
Speaking of which, before you forget, the number one show on Earth happens to have a gay couple as, you know, I wouldn't say the main protagonist, but one of the main characters, Ross, I can't remember his last name, on The Walking Dead. The guy's amazing at imitations, his imitation game at some point. I guess the only negative there is you don't really get to see him and his partner that very, very much. But when you do, they are presented like, you know, it doesn't feel like stereotypes, not to me as a viewer. It feels like, mm-hmm. you know, just it's a couple and you're not questioning what kind of couple. It's a couple in love in the apocalypse, you know? But I think that's pretty cool for a show. I mean, obviously, Walking Dead's a pretty diverse show anyway, mm-hmm. for people love it or hate it.
It's still the number one show in the world, huh?
I'm sure it still is, yeah. It is, right?
Wow.
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah. And I mean, Game of Thrones couldn't pass it because it's not on, cable. Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, we'll be coming back soon. But anyway, I don't know if you guys have seen that show or not the characters.
I like those characters. I read the graphic novels for a while, but I kind of dropped out of the show. And Chris, I know you said you didn't have a lot to bring to the table, but is there any movie you can think of that you want to recommend?
On this topic?
Yeah.
No, I mean, we brought it up earlier, and I definitely want to come back to it, which is Rope.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We kind of glazed over it
that was a movie that was not subtext. I mean, it was mm-hmm. very clear that they were a gay couple. And I think that it's such a, I mean, it was overshadowed, unfortunately, by a technical gimmick.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When I think that the really interesting thing about that movie was the fact that it was, yeah, that it was way ahead of its time.
And Loeb storyline.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's, see, actually, I more than that, I like Strangers on a Train. And I, what I love about that is the character who, the bad guy, who's just the one of the best performances of all time, in my opinion, who is clearly playing a gay character and that is not gay. And Farley Granger playing the heterosexual straight guy is gay in real life. And I always love that.
Yeah.
It's an amazing dynamic between those two on screen.
But Hitchcock was a filmmaker I think was also like not afraid of going there.
And absolutely. Dark places and sexuality in general. He would go there in ways that people weren't even aware he was going there most of the
time.
And
it's a pretty cool movie.
Yeah.
So do you think that he knowingly made it like use the technical facet to it as a smokescreen to kind of slip through and smuggle in the kind of
I don't know.
I wonder if that's how he kind of won. Yeah.
Obviously on Psycho that he would do stuff to distract from what was happening in the shower scene.
Very possible.
For those that don't realize, rope is the technical gimmick. It's not really, but they sell it as if it's all one shot. All in one shot. Yeah.
But it's still amazing at the time, given 10-minute reels.
Totally.
A lot of the shots are really fluid.
Yeah.
It makes the shot. It's a little slow because of that.
Yeah.
But it's very cleverly masked. Like even the way that they cover some of the edits, it's very clever for the time period.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point too. It's like, oh, I can't cut out the gay subtext because it's in this 10-minute chunk and it's all one shot.
Well, and also you could look at that also as Jimmy Stewart trying to figure them out. Like, it's not to catch the curtain.
Oh, yeah.
What's your sexuality?
Yeah.
It has a little bit of that old America to that character. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that is like a lot of gay characters, especially in older movies, were cast as villains because we were viewed as the other
outsider.
And outsiders that. And I don't want to like bring it down, but I do want to mention that most transsexual representation in media is pointing them as villains. Mm. And that is wrong, even though some of those movies are very good, like Silence of the Lambs.
Sure.
I actually have a list that I have been compiling of movies with transsexual villains, and you'd be surprised. There's like
Could you post that?
Like,
could that be something we just post so we can
post? Sleep Away Camp by now.
Yeah. No, there's not that
Dressed to Kill.
Okay. Yeah, Dressed to Kill, Psycho. Where did it go? I don't want to say that one because it's a spoiler. They're all spoilers.
Dressed to Kill's a spoiler.
Okay. Well, okay. Spoiler alert. I'm going to run through this in like 15 seconds.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Sleepaway Camp. Uh-huh. Private Parts, which is great.
Yeah.
Deadly Blessing, the Wes Craven movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1982 parody slasher Pandemonium. Tab Hunter is the killer in that.
Of course. Yeah, there you go.
And he's killing cheerleaders because he can never be one when he was a teen. It's really interesting, actually. It's crazy. That movie's weird.
That movie is bizarre. Like, I can't even recommend that movie to people. It's just weird.
But there's a great documentary on Tab Hunter coming out.
Tab Hunter Confidential came out a couple of years ago.
Great.
It's one of the best documentaries.
It's pretty amazing. He talks about, I heard him on the NPR, he talks about how he's a star, he's peddled as a heterosexual, and literally the studio will call and find the celebrity actress who they're going to pair you up to go to events just to be seen together, and just the way they work to cover, they know your sexuality, but they're just there to cover up. I mean, there's lots of Montgomery Clift, who's one of my favorite actors, out as well. So it's fascinating.
It's ridiculous.
What movies in Hollywood and society have done to cover these things up.
Yeah.
Well, we have to wrap it up. Sorry. We should wrap it up, but Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Happy Death Day out today.
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun. And what's cool is that right now, obviously it's Halloween season and there's I like all kinds of horror, but it's kind of counter programming for something like, say, Saw, which is next week. It's the complete, this is just a very fun movie. Me and him had a blast watching it last week. And I think everybody that's listening is going to, especially if you love just slasher movies, this is a really fun take on them. And stick around to the very, very end because there's some fun stuff at the very end, which I mentioned to you that made the movie for me. So.
Awesome. Yeah, and support horror in theaters in October. I always want horror movies to come out this month because it's something to look forward to every year.
Yeah, not August.
Chris, October.
What are you doing for Halloween, Chris?
Trick-or-treating.
Nice.
Yeah.
How old are your kids now?
6 months.
He's trick-or-treating. Oh. Yeah.
You took him out when they're 6 months. That's when you dress it up like a little lamb and it's just a ball of
fluff. I keep waiting for him to be big enough to be Chucky. And then
perfect.
Super excited.
All right,
Chris, thank you so much.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.